All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
On my papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and light me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient
tools. Oh. Right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. You hear me? Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. It is Thursday morning here on WGN. Now, thanks for tuning in here till 5. Coming up on the show after the 1:30 news, the co-founder of Bloodshot Records, Rob Miller, is going to join us, celebrating 25 years. Bloodshot Records, a great label that's put out a lot of music. Their new compilation is coming out to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Bloodshot Records. It's called Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots. And, yeah, there's a bunch of songs on it. Great artists that have been part of Bloodshot Records for all these 25 years. And Rob Miller, co-founder of Bloodshot Records, will join us after the 1:30 news. We are also going to Steve McQueen died on this date in 1980. So we're going to talk about Steve McQueen, who was like the coolest dude in the world. And we're going to talk about some essential Steve McQueen performances. Martin Scorsese has got a new movie coming out this weekend. So we're going to rank the Martin Scorsese movies as well. And there you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to talk about some digital de-aging in movies, because that's a big part, actually, of The Irishman, Scorsese's new movie. Everybody's talking about how they've made Pacino and De Niro and Pesci look younger. And some people are a little bit weirded out by that because, this technology is being used all the time. And so there you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, you can, at Nick D Show. Our Facebook page is updated all the time, and it's facebook.com/Nick D Show. So you can jump into that anytime you want. And you can also download our podcast. Subscribe to our podcast. Every single second of every single show is podcast. And then you can find it at iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can go to WGNradio.com, subscribe to the podcast. It's free. It'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. All right, let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you doing, man?
I'm not bad. Not bad. It's Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You made it.
Yeah.
To Thursday.
It's Thursday. This week has gone by pretty quick.
Yeah, you just kind of blink and you miss it.
Yeah. So Bloodshot Records, you're a fan, right?
Yeah, big fan of Bloodshot Records, especially when I was at my college radio gig over at Loyola. We played a lot of Bloodshot, and I knew people that interned at Bloodshot. They love the college radio crowd, and we love them.
Yeah.
Big fan of what they do.
Well, Rob Miller, co-founder, is going to join us to talk about it. 25 years. 25 years they've been around.
It feels like longer.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems like... You know, I've never really known a world without Bloodshot Records, and they're such an institution that's like, oh, they must have been around for, what, 50 years, something like that?
You're a year older than Bloodshot Records.
I know. So. Looking down on them. Well, young whippersnappers.
That's right. So that's coming up here on the show. This whole de-aging thing, the CGI stuff that they're doing, we're going to talk about taking it way too far. After the break, when we come back, they're actually casting James Dean in a movie. James Dean's been dead for, 64 years or something like that? He's been dead? And he's going to be in a movie. And people are speaking out about it. Not good. I think that's ridiculous.
It's a sentence I never thought I would hear in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But it's very 2019. Yeah, we're just going to bring back this guy from the dead. We're going to put him in a movie.
It's just absurd. It's completely absurd. And celebrities are speaking out about it. A lot of people are speaking out about it. I'll tell you all about it. Hollywood Reporter did a big piece on it, so we'll talk a little bit about it. But this is getting a little bit weird now. So, remember when Fred Astaire danced with a vacuum cleaner in a commercial and everybody went nuts?
Wait, what commercial?
This was years ago. I would think it might have been even before you were born. But there was a bit, I can't remember what brand of vacuum cleaner it was, but they took Fred Astaire from one of his movies and they CGI'd him or whatever, you know, technology was used back then, and they put him in the commercial dancing with a vacuum cleaner. And that was like a cause for outrage at that time. And now James Dean's going to be cast in a movie. It's completely absurd.
I'm guessing that's what Fred Astaire would have wanted his talents to be used for.
Yeah, to sell a vacuum cleaner. All right, let's go into the newsroom. It's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, man?
Doing very well.
Yeah. All right. Thursday morning here. And Vic's in the newsroom. Vic, do you remember that commercial where Fred Astaire was dancing with a vacuum cleaner?
Yep.
And what the outrage that it caused?
It blew my mind when I saw it.
Yeah.
And we've come a long way since then, too.
Yeah, we're going to put James Dean in a movie now.
I had not heard that. That is bizarre.
It's completely
insane. It's happening?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a Vietnam War movie.
Wow.
And they're going to put James Dean in it 64 years after his death.
I could see why people would come out and say, whoa, 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 whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on
a second. It's absurd.
A war he wasn't even alive to see.
Right.
Just because we can do things doesn't mean we should.
Yes, you are absolutely right.
Wow.
You are absolutely right. Just because we can do things doesn't mean we should. That's the sentence of the morning right there. Yeah.
This is Jurassic Park level.
Yeah. God. Man, oh, man. So, now Jurassic Park was a seminal movie for you, right?
Of course, yeah. Came out the year I was born.
Came out the year you were born.
In June of 1993.
Yeah.
Released, it was in theaters at the same time as Schindler's List, both directed by Steven Spielberg concurrently.
Yeah.
Couldn't be more different. Both amazing landmarks of the 90s.
Not a fan of either of them.
Oh, wait, you don't like Schindler's List?
No, I don't.
Wow.
No, I don't like
that. That is a take.
Yeah. I don't, you know, not a popular opinion, but not a fan of that movie.
Not even Ray Fiennes as the commandant?
Listen, some of the acting in it is really good. I'm not a fan of the film. Ray Fiennes is despicable in it. I mean.
Of course.
But it's a great performance. But yeah.
You got to hand it to Spielberg, though.
No, that was a good year for him. 1993 was a very, very good year for him. No arguing that. A massive year for him. And then Schindler's List goes on to win all the Academy Awards and everything. While I was rooting for The Piano. Mm-hmm. At least Holly Hunter won.
Yeah.
Holly. And
Anna Paquin.
Yeah, Anna Paquin won.
I think she set the record that year for youngest person ever win an Academy Award.
Did she? Yeah, maybe she did, because I know Tatum O'Neill was really young when she won for Paper Moon. But Anna Paquin may have been younger. She was adorable with her speech. Her speech was just fantastic. But yeah, no, Piano was my favorite film that year. 93 was a good year for movies too, if I remember correctly. That was a really strong year for movies. But yeah, The Piano was the one that I went nuts over. So. But Jurassic Park, I've said this before, I remember seeing Jurassic Park in 1993, and this was, you know, probably seven years before I started watching Seinfeld, but Seinfeld was like the biggest show on TV in 1993. And so when, what's his name, Wayne Knight? Wayne Knight shows up in Jurassic Park, someone yelled out, Newman! In the theater, it was at the Biograph Theater, somebody yelled out, Newman! And everybody started laughing, and I had no idea what that was. I had no idea what that reference was. I was like, what are people laughing at? And then someone had to tell me that he plays this character named Newman on Seinfeld. And who would have known that 7 years later I would become obsessed with Seinfeld and now know every single episode? But I never watched it once when it was on in the 90s. Except the finale. I did watch the final episode, and I had no idea what the hell was happening.
Probably threw you off a bit.
I just said, well, I don't know what's going on. I watched it because it was an event. So, yeah. But, yeah, Jurassic Park. And now, what do we are they making another Jurassic World?
Yeah, it's going to happen at some point.
Because the last one did pretty well, right?
The last one did well. Yeah, it did really well. Not as well as Jurassic World.
No, the first Jurassic World did much better, actually, if I'm not mistaken. Jurassic World was a massive hit.
Oh, it made tons and tons of
money. I think it made more money than any of the Jurassic Park movies.
I'd say probably.
And it wasn't even good. I like the last one. That's my favorite of all the Jurassic movies was the last.
I'll never understand
that. The last one.
Every time you say it, I never understand it.
Yeah. Just bring Jeff Goldblum back. That's what they did. They basically just plopped him in the movie. He didn't even do anything.
Well, now the whole crew is going to be back. It's going to be Jeff Goldblum, Sam Neill.
Oh, is Laura Dern coming back?
Laura Dern as Eileen Sadler.
Well, you can't bring back Richard Attenborough, right?
No, he is dead.
Yeah, he passed away.
Well, now with the CGI.
Well, sure. They can bring back.
I was going to say, guys.
James Dean in Jurassic World 3.
James Dean is going to be in Jurassic World. That's right. Well, listen, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you this whole story of them CGIing James Dean into a Vietnam movie. I mean, that's just too much. It's too much. What'd you say, Vic? Just because we can do it doesn't mean we should.
Bingo.
Got it. All right. Let's take a quick break here on WGN. When we come back, we'll talk about James Dean coming back from the grave. Oh, man. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Oh, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Yeah, Steve McQueen passed away on this date in 1980, so we're going to talk about Steve McQueen and some of the most essential Steve McQueen performances in movies. Martin Scorsese's got a new movie coming out. We're going to talk about his movies as well. And if you want to jump in at any time, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Also for Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. So get your requests in now. That's one artist, three songs. Get them in. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. After the 1:30 news, Rob Miller, co-founder of Bloodshot Records, is going to join us to talk about the 25th anniversary and a big release for Bloodshot Records. Okay, so we were talking before the break that this whole CGI, we've got people being de-aged in movies like in the Irishman and all these other things, and we're using these computer and CGI technology, this CGI technology, now to bring dead people back. Zelda Williams, whose late father Robin Williams has restricted exploitation of his image, spoke out on the casting news of James Dean being CGI'd into a movie. Publicity stunt or not, this is puppeteering the dead and their clout alone, and it is such an awful precedent for the future of performance, she said. James Dean has been cast in a Vietnam War-era action drama 64 years after his death, creating a social media uproar with those in the industry finding the casting shameful and setting an awful precedent for the future of film and visual effects. Magic City Films announced Wednesday that the late Rebel Without a Cause star, who died in a car crash in 1955 at the age of 24, would take the secondary lead role in their upcoming film, Finding Jack. I can't even believe I'm reading this. By the way, if you want to jump in with your thoughts on this, text or talk right now at 312-981-7200. I mean, it's absurd. The movie, adapted by Maria Sova from Gareth Crocker's novel, focuses on the abandonment of more than 10,000 military dogs at the end of the Vietnam War. Dean, who died just before the start of the war, would be portraying a character named Rogan. Despite directors Anton Ernst and Tati Golic obtaining the rights to use the actor's image from his family, reactions to the casting have been overwhelmingly negative. I'm just surprised that the family said it was okay. I don't understand that at all. I have talked to friends about this for years, and no one ever believed me that the industry would stoop this low once the tech got better, tweeted Zelda Williams, who's, again, late father was Robin Williams. This is awful, Knives Out star Chris Evans wrote on Twitter. Maybe we can get a computer to paint us a new Picasso, or write a couple of new John Lennon tunes. The complete lack of understanding here is shameful. Agree 100% with Chris Evans. Elijah Wood echoes Evans' criticism, tweeting, "Nope, this should not be a thing." Michelle Buckman, who runs social media for Star Wars, was one of several on social media who blasted the notion of an actor who looked like James Dean could not be found in the cast. This is literally a James Dean festival held. There is literally a James Dean festival held every year in Indiana where they have a lookalike contest. So if you really needed someone, it's not that hard to find them, posted Buckman, referring to Fairmount, Indiana's annual festival dedicated to the late actor. Ernst told The Hollywood Reporter that his team had, quote, searched high and low for the perfect character to portray the role of Rogan until deciding that Dean could portray the extreme complex character arcs of the role. Julianne Emery highlighted the concern over how the role would be credited, given another actor will voice Dean's role and his performance will be constructed via full-body CGI using actual footage and photos. That's not James Dean. It's his face on a motion capture performance and an anonymous actor providing voice pattern and choices, the actress wrote on Twitter. I'd like to know how it will be credited, how the real actors will be paid, and how little this team understands the acting craft. Devin Sawa, who auditioned for another role in Finding Jack, also commented on the casting of a deceased actor, tweeting, "They couldn't give this role to an actual human?" It's ridiculous.
I do find it a little ironic that the Star Wars people were saying anything
about
it.
Since they brought Peter Cushing back to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was not really, it wasn't really a big speaking role. He was more of a stand-in.
Yeah, I got to say this. You know, as everybody who regularly listens to this show knows that I worship Peter Cushing. Peter Cushing is one of my heroes. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Peter Cushing. I know that sounds weird, you know, because most people wanted to be a baseball player or an astronaut or something when I was a kid. I wanted to be Van Helsing. I wanted to be Peter Cushing. I thought he was such a badass in The Horror of Dracula. That last scene in The Horror of Dracula where he tears down the curtains, he jumps on the table, takes the two candlesticks and puts them together. I was like, he's the king of the world. So it was weird when I saw Rogue One. I got a little teary-eyed, I'm not going to lie, because they did a great job. You know, I mean, it looked exactly like him, and whoever provided the voice sounded exactly like Peter Cushing. And I thought I was weirded out by it. But the thing is, Grand Moff Tarkin has to be in there. You know what I mean? They could have cast another guy. The actor that they put in at the end of Sith.
Yeah.
Right, where at the very end, where Darth Vader is looking he's standing on the deck and he's looking at the Death Star being built. That's how Sith ends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who they had. He didn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
He just walked into the frame. The guy looked exactly like Peter Cushing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, it was a very strange thing. But this is a lead performance in a movie. He's in like two scenes in Rogue One. Like the Peter Cushing CGI. He's in like two scenes in Rogue One. And again, he's such an iconic character to that series. I can kind of understand why they would CGI Peter Cushing in it. Because you can't do a prequel to Star Wars setting up the entire trilogy and not have Grand Moff Tarkin in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially where that movie takes place in the whole timeline.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have him in there. I also love the fact that Peter Cushing is actually, you know, he's the main villain in Star Wars. It's not Darth Vader. It's him.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I also think it's pretty cool that, you know, despite the fact that the trilogy that came out in the 90s or the 2000s,
mm-hmm.
The prequels. I one of the cool things that I think George Lucas did was cast, I thought it was cool that he cast Christopher Lee in those movies. I was like, okay, that's cool. You got Peter Cushing and then Christopher Lee.
He was working a lot. He was
in the Lord of the Rings movies too, man.
Right,
he was all over the place.
I think the only example of this that I found that I thought was appropriate, the CGI recreation thing, was Fast and Furious 7, because Paul Walker died in the middle of filming it.
Right.
And they were like, this movie has to get made. So they brought in his brothers and they had him finish the performances. But
right.
Paul Walker is actually in that movie, just not.
He's not. Yeah, yeah. He is in the movie. But I think this is absurd. It just shouldn't be happening. Somebody should like stop it. I can't believe that James Dean's family thought this was okay. So, all right. Hey, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should. That's the advice of the great Vic Vaughn. All right. We're going to hear from Vic Vaughn in just a couple of minutes in the newsroom, and we'll do that right after this.
Last honky-tonk in Chicago today has shuttered up its doors. And I know old Buck Owens would be happy that his sweetheart won't be found there anymore.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday coming up. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. And Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Yeah. We're going to talk about Steve McQueen on this day. He died at the age of 50 on this date, so we're going to go back and look at some of the best Steve McQueen performances, and we've got some other fun stuff to talk about as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. That music you heard was The Last Honky Tonk in Chicago by Wild Earp and the Free-for-Alls, and it's part of the celebration of the 25th anniversary of Bloodshot Records, which is a pretty amazing label, an amazing place. And Tom, you and I were talking off the air about how many artists got their starts, how many great artists got their starts on Bloodshot.
Yeah, if you just roll through, you know, every artist that's come and went and who are recording now, it's unbelievable the roster that they've put together
really
over the last 25 years.
It really is. And they're celebrating their 25th anniversary with a release called Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots Bloodshot Records 25th Anniversary Compilation, which is out tomorrow. We're very excited to have the co-founder of Bloodshot Records talking about the history of the Bloodshot Records, and it's Rob Miller. Rob, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thank you. Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great, except I feel both old and so uncool to find out that it's Steve McQueen's, that he was just 50 when he died.
He was only 50, man. I remember that one hit me like a ton of bricks because, he was the definition of cool. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Rob, tell everybody who might not know, tell everybody about Bloodshot Records and how it got started.
We got started in the winter of 1993. Myself and a couple other music fans got together and thought we would put together a compilation of bands that we saw around Chicago that were not getting much attention and who were all working in various different forms of roots music. And we stitched together a compilation called For a Life of Sin, and we pressed up 1,000 copies, thought it would get us into some shows, get some free drinks, and that would be that.
Well, that's very, very cool. What's your background, Rob?
I started off in college radio and in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and was just always a huge music fan, and eventually worked my way into doing live production and sound production and being a stage manager and production manager in and around the Detroit area, and then just got burnt out on that and moved to Chicago to get away from the music world. And that worked out. Tremendously.
Yeah, I was
well.
Going to say that. Sounded like that panned out pretty well. Yeah, you wanted to get away from the
nothing but net. Nothing but net.
It's funny that you were like, I got to get away from music, so I'm going to go to Chicago, which is one of the best music towns in the country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I first got here, I was just astounded at how many different clubs were presenting live music every night in so many different neighborhoods. It was just... it was just kind of look at the Chicago Reader and take your pick of where you wanted to be on any given night.
Absolutely. You know, one of the artists that you've worked with, I've seen like 8,000 times. That's the Western Elstons because I used to bartend and hang out at Simon's. and they've played there so many times. And they're a terrific band. How do you find the bands that you guys put on your label?
Every band has a different Genesis story. Sometimes it's other bands of ours will tell us about somebody that opened for them or that they played with or saw at a festival. A couple have been cold calls. One guy came into the office and handed us his demo and said, I'm going to be on your label. And, you know, it just go down the list and I can tell you a weird story about almost every one of them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right, look.
I can tell you how it doesn't happen. And that's not through a bunch of people sitting in a office going through a focus group or something about what we should or shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
A few years ago, we put out an album by a Danish pedal steel player named Maggie Bjorklund, which does not scream, you know, intelligent decision. Yeah. But we just love the record so much, we found that we had to do it.
How often is that the reason for releasing a record? I mean, that's got to be the main reason, because I mean, you've maintained this for 25 years. It's got to be like what we like is what we like, and we're going to release it.
Yeah, there's no other reason to do it. If you don't feel passionate about it, how do you expect the fans to? And it's gratifying when popular culture and taste, kind of the Venn diagram with us, overlaps, and we get something that kind of breaks into a broader audience. But it's certainly not what drives us.
Yeah, it's so the Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots Bloodshot Records 25th Anniversary Compilation is out tomorrow, the 8th. Tell me about how you put that together.
Well, we've often loved doing compilations through the years, and like I said, the first one was based in Chicago, and we were kicking around ideas on what to do for the 25th, and people from all over the country and all over the world were suggesting things and offering up tracks, but I felt it was important to revisit the city, to kind of come home in a way, to show that it wasn't just a flash in the pan, that this community of artists is still growing and morphing and mixing, and there's a handful of artists on this record that were on the first record, and now they are such a part of the fabric of the city. You can't imagine talking about Chicago music without talking about Robbie Folks or John Lankford or the Handsome Family.
Yeah.
Freakwater, Kelly Hogan. But then there's all these new people that, quite frankly, a few of them I'd never even heard of. And it's, you know, the way to look smart is surround yourself with really good, talented people. And the people in the staff in the office are also passionate music fans. And they were, you know, they're out in the clubs as much or more than I am, and they're coming to me with these suggestions. So we were able to, in pretty short order, put together these 22 songs.
Wow, that's great.
That just show the breadth of talent that's happening in this city in just this kind of one genre.
Yeah, that's great. And by the way, there's an album release show at Workshop 4200. I've never been there. It's at 4200 West Diversey.
Yeah, it's a really cool space. It's the old Hammond Organ Factory.
Oh,
so it's this
right.
Beautiful,
right,
industrial.
Right.
Yeah, great bow truss ceilings, and it's where the record was actually pressed. There's the vinyl pressing plant, Smash Plastic, pressed this record up, and they have there's this great performance space, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. Hot Dog will be there. He made a special sausage for us.
Oh, awesome!
And
what's the sausage consist of?
So if you hate music, at the very least, you're going to get a sausage.
Well, what is the sausage? Tell me what it is.
It's kind of a Chicago take on a Texas hot link, because Chicago's got and Bloodshot has such a strong connection to Austin and Texas.
Yeah.
That Doug came by the office one day, and we just started kicking around ideas, and that's kind of what we came up with.
Boy, Doug's a great guy. I've had him on the show several times.
Yeah, when Doug starts, you know, when you see the wheels start to spin, you know, my job is just get out of the way.
Yeah, so that's Saturday, November 9th. That's this Saturday, 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. Nice long celebration, album release. You're going to have, we played a little bit of Wild Earp and the Free For Alls. They're going to be there, too. Big Sadie, Rookie, David Quinn, and the Dyes.
Absolutely. It's a great representation of bands that fit together but are also totally different.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's really fantastic. Now, when you guys started Bloodshot, was there a specific genre in mind, or did you just wanted to get any kind of music out there?
Well, we wanted to keep it focused on this unheralded, undocumented scene that was happening in Chicago, that where people were hitting on various forms of roots music and bringing their own backgrounds to it and kind of messing it up and morphing it into strange new things. And early on, to this day, we kept that focus somewhat. I think that's helped separate us from a lot of other indie labels, and it's helped us keep our identity. Everything's got kind of some kind of touchstone to traditional roots music, but what they do with it is never endingly fascinating to me.
Outstanding. So again, Saturday, workshop 4200 from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. And then you have a Chicago Honky Tonk matinee at the Empty Bottle on Sunday, November 17th, featuring Kelly Hogan and the aforementioned the Western Elstons.
Yeah, that, I mean, and that is, you know, one of the things that I love about this city and about the kind of vibe that we embrace. It's just like it's this great ongoing years-long party every weekend at the Empty Bottle,
yeah.
You know, and to have Kelly Hogan and the Empty Bottle, I mean, that, why wouldn't you go see that?
Fantastic, yeah. Rob, hang on, okay?
I got nowhere to be.
Okay, hang on a second. Rob Miller is with us, co-founder of Bloodshot Records, celebrating their 25th anniversary with a compilation record that's out tomorrow. And we'll talk more about Bloodshot Records with Rob right after we take a break here on 720 WGN.
Big town, they're the monsters on the prowl, fucking round, crashing round, hanging in the air, there's trouble everywhere, tear me down.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. And that was more from the compilation, Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots, and that was John Langford, John Langford's Hillbilly Love Child. And we're going to be they're going to be celebrating the 25th anniversary of Bloodshot Records, and Rob Miller, co-founder, is with us. Rob, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, so how do you feel about the changes in music over the past 25 years? The music business, how people get their music now, which is mostly on their phone. As you've navigated through this for 25 years, tell me a little bit about how you feel about how the music business has changed.
Changes? I haven't noticed any changes. What are you talking about?
It's exactly the same as it was 25 years ago. Yeah,
exactly. I tell people when we first started, I would have to get on the train and go down to the Harold Washington Library to the telephone book room. They had a room full of telephone books from all over the country.
Yeah,
and I would look up where record stores were or clubs, so that we could write them letters to see if they would carry our records or wow. book our band.
Wow.
Things like that.
Amazing.
It's hard to argue with the convenience of streaming and downloading. And, you know, we live in a culture where there's this increasing awareness and appreciation for locality and for craftsmanship and, you know, craft breweries, craft distilleries, local restaurants, farm to table stuff, local artisans, and people are willing to pay for that. And it's just perpetually vexing to me that that hasn't really translated to music, that people are willing to just spend, you know, micro pennies to artists that they purport to love. And it's kind of unsustainable. You'll pay $14 for a drink that has honey in it from the beehive on the roof, but to ask you somebody to pay, you know, $5, $10 for a record is just, it's a deal breaker.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone is so willing to give whatever little money they do pay for music to giant corporations that themselves have not created a note of music. You know, Tim Cook, Jeff Bezos, Lollapalooza, all these giant monolithic companies, that's where all the money's going. And it just seems very counterintuitive to what we are all trying to do as labels and as musicians and artists.
And as making that statement, how do you guys deal with that on a daily basis?
All you can do is really try and educate your audience and just tell them, the very real basic economics of this endeavor that we're doing and that our artists are doing. I mean, none of our artists are, you know, we're not talking about Beyonce here or people making billions of dollars. We're talking about people who could really use that money to put in the tank of their van so that they could make the next show, so that they could maybe do this again next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're taking time away from their families and their jobs to kind of exist on the fringes, and every lost sale hurts, and every all the amount of time that they spend like hawking t-shirts or like, you know, endless Instagram posts or stuff like that is time that they're taking away from what they're really good at doing, which is writing songs and performing them.
Yeah. Now, but you know what? I will say this. There's a bright spot here, though. Don't you think that the resurgence in popularity of vinyl is a good thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not replacing the lost revenue, but, you know, from a record geek perspective, which you obviously have to be to run a label for 25 years.
Right.
Yeah, aesthetically and sonically, yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled that people are enjoying vinyl again. And I think vinyl speaks to this totemic connection to the artist and to the music that, you know, having 47,000 songs on your hard drive doesn't really speak to. You know, if you have a nice, solid hunk of vinyl in your hands, it speaks a little more intimately to the to your fandom and to your connection to the music.
I think it's really great that, I mean, all major artists now are doing pressings of vinyl. Like when they release something, they release it on vinyl as well, and they sell it sells really well. I've found that over the years, that's really pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's you know, we when we started pressing stuff on vinyl, the majors had yet to really catch on, and you know, we kind of had that lane to ourselves for a while. And then one time I went down to we were pressing our records in Nashville for a while, and I was getting the runaround from my rep, which I usually didn't get. And I went down there to see what the problem was, and I went into the warehouse, and there was a pile of LPs the size of my apartment.
Huh.
And it was all Pearl Jam LPs. And I was like, oh, that's why you're not really paying attention to my paltry little reorder of 500 LPs.
That's something.
So it's great to have somebody like Smash Plastic open up in town where I can just drive down the street and go pick some up. And,
I just want to mention one more time, the album release show is on this Saturday at Workshop 4200 at 4200 West Diversey in Chicago, 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. Rookie, Wild Earp and the Free of Thralls, Big Sadie, David Quinn, and the Dyes will all be playing. And there's also a Honky Tonk matinee on Sunday, November 17th at Empty Bottle with Kelly Hogan and the Western Alstons. On a personal note, I wanted to ask you wrote a piece about the National Parks Foundation. And your love for national parks. Tell me about that. How did that start?
Well, we, that's very nice of you. January 2017 rolled around and, some things were being said, out of Washington, D.C., and I was being called a hater and an enemy and all that, and the Orwellian neologism of alternative facts got thrown out into the world. We thought, what can we do to play on that? And so we came up with this alt country, not alt facts t-shirt that we have sold many thousands of, and 100% of the profits we were donating to the National Parks Foundation.
Mm.
And we ended up raising tens of thousands of dollars for that. And we sent it to them, and they said, hey, would you want to write about this? And I said, sure. And I wrote that piece, and it was great to be a part of, and it's still great that we keep selling these things and keep sending the money.
And people can get the shirt online at Bloodshot.
Yeah, at our bloodshotrecords.com. Absolutely,
bloodshotrecords.com. Well, that's pretty great that you care enough. What are some of your experiences at national parks in the past?
Well, I mean, the first national park I think I went to was, you know, the classic family trip to Yellowstone.
Sure.
And being from, you know, Detroit, seeing something like Yellowstone just, you know, as a 9-10 year old kid just blows your mind that there are these places on earth like this. And then as you get older and you're fortunate enough to get to go travel to other ones, then you just realize what a special, amazing thing this whole national park system is, and how it really needs to be protected.
Yeah. Well, I admire you're doing this for the national park system. It's a really very cool thing, and it's nice to be tied in with your label. And congratulations on 25 years. Can you believe it's been 25 years, Ron?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we started this as a lark with no expectation of longevity or any kind of success, and it was, you know, I was drywalling apartments in Rogers Park and Lakeview and stuff, and it was just kind of something to break the tedium of that and kind of get back into music a little bit.
Yeah.
And then here we are, and we've gotten to work with people who we were at the beginning of their careers and help introduce them to the world. And then, you know, I got to work with a lot of people whose records I had in my collection before the label.
Yeah.
People like John Langford, Alejandro Escovedo, Wanda Jackson, people like that. I mean, that's just an incredible lark that is turned into something.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on all that. By the way, your office, your headquarters is like 10 blocks right down from where I live.
Well, come on by.
Yeah, I will. It's within walking distance from where I live. So the album release show, Saturday night at Workshop 4200 West Diversey in Chicago from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. The Chicago Honky Tonk Matinee is Sunday, November 17th at the Empty Bottle. And the record is released tomorrow, the 8th. And that is Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots Bloodshot Records 25th Anniversary Compilation. Rob, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and congratulations on all this.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Okay.
and for the attention. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. Take care.
All right. Good night.
There you go. Rob Miller, the co-founder of Bloodshot Records, celebrating its 25th anniversary. Too Late to Pray, Defiant Chicago Roots. That's the record that'll be out on the 8th. Go to bloodshotrecords.com for more information and all kinds of cool stuff. And you can follow him on Twitter at BSHQ. BSHQ. Bloodshotrecords.com. Congratulations on the 25th anniversary of Bloodshot Records. Doing great, great stuff here in the city. Okay, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Shouldn't this be preceded by David Caruso saying something clever and putting his sunglasses on?
Nah, that's Won't Get Fooled Again.
Oh, that's Won't Get Fooled Again.
This is the OG CSI, right?
Yeah. That's regular CSI, right?
Yeah, Who Are You is regular CSI.
Oh, okay.
And then you're talking CSI Miami.
CSI Miami.
David Caruso, man.
Looks like he won't be home for dinner.
Yeah!
The stupidest thing in the world. Putting the sunglasses on. No, that's his thing, man. That's David Caruso's thing. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Who requested Triple Play Thursday? We get to hear a couple more Who songs.
That's coming to us from John.
All right, John. There you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to text us or talk to us. We're going to be discussing Steve McQueen. Do you have favorite Steve McQueen movies or moments? He passed away on this date in 1980. Earlier, before we talked with Rob about the 25th anniversary of Bloodshot, I was telling you about the story that they're reviving James Dean via CGI to be in a Vietnam movie. And, of course, we all think it's ridiculous that they're going to do that. So we had a couple of texts of people who were listening about that. And it says, 847 area code says, The Simpsons did an episode years ago where they used dead celebrities in ads, had Homer kill celebrities. That's why we should all watch The Simpsons. The show predicts everything. 847 area code says, will they CGI Dean's old agent to negotiate future roles?
My client is the hottest teen star in America.
Yeah. In 2019, despite the fact that he's been dead for 64 years.
And I've been dead for 62.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. So, anyway, I guess they're going ahead with it. Absolutely absurd, but they're going ahead with it.
They've got the family's permission.
It's so stupid. All right. I wonder if they're going to make a Steve McQueen movie now.
Well, hopefully we'd get Damian Lewis to play him.
Yeah, God, he was great in Once Upon a Time. I love Damian Lewis, man. You ever see the movie Keen?
No, you've mentioned it to me before. It's on the never ending list.
It's God, my ex-wife hated it. She hated it. We were dating at the time before we got married, and we went to see it at the Landmark. And as soon as the credits came out, she just got up and left. She just walked out, and so she hated it. And I love the movie. It's a bit of an assault, you know. And his performance is unbelievable. Like Damian Lewis is unbelievable in that movie. And that was Abigail Breslin was in that before she did Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good movie. Well, Steve McQueen. On November 7, 1980, the actor Steve McQueen, one of Hollywood's leading men of the 60s and 70s, and the star of such action thrillers as Bullet and The Towering Inferno, died at the age of 50 in Mexico, where he was undergoing an experimental treatment for cancer. In 1979, McQueen had been diagnosed with mesothelioma, a type of cancer often related to asbestos exposure. It was later believed that the ruggedly handsome actor, who had an affinity for fast cars and motorcycles, might have been exposed to asbestos by wearing racing suits. I do remember that story. You know, it's Terrence Stephen McQueen was born March 24th, 1930, in Beech Grove, Indiana. After a troubled youth that included time in reform school, McQueen served in the U.S. Marine Corps in the late 40s. He then studied acting and began competing in motorcycle races. He made his big screen debut with a tiny role in 1956, Somebody Up There Likes Me, starring Paul Newman. McQueen went on to appear in the camp classic The Blob in 1958 and gained fame playing a bounty hunter on TV series Wanted Dead or Alive, which aired originally on CBS from 58 to 61. Do you ever watch Wanted Dead or Alive?
No,
it's great. It's great. And that's kind of loosely what the Rutger Hauer movie was kind of based on.
Mm-hmm.
The Gary Sherman Rutger Hauer movie, Wanted Dead or Alive. During the 60s, McQueen built a reputation for playing cool loner heroes in a list of films that included the Western The Magnificent Seven in 1960s, which was directed by John Sturges and also featured Yul Brynner and Charles Bronson. Another great movie.
Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of Seven Samurai. What it's based on. But as far as adaptations go, it pretty much doesn't get any better than that with the Magnificent Seven.
I got to say, I enjoyed the one with Denzel. I enjoyed it. I particularly like was Chris Pratt was in that.
Chris Pratt
was great in that movie.
Yeah. That's just a tough one. That's a tall order to try and do just a straight remake.
Yeah.
Of The Magnificent Seven.
I enjoyed it. Antoine Foucault directed that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And D'Onofrio was fantastic in that movie, too.
It's a great cast.
Yeah.
They picked a lot of the right people, but it was a lot of the same.
The Great Escape, 1963, in which McQueen played a U.S. soldier in World War II who makes a daring motorcycle escape from a German prison camp. Another great movie. Which, of course, is recreated again in the great moment in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And The Sand Pebbles from 1966, a war epic for which he received a Best Actor Oscar nomination. McQueen played a detective in one of his most popular movies, 1968's Bullet, which featured a spectacular car chase through the streets of San Francisco. And that same year, the actor portrayed an elegant thief in The Thomas Crown Affair. Now, I could have done without the remake of that.
What, with Pierce?
Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan?
Yeah.
Ah, it's fine.
I like the original.
Sure.
I like the original too much.
Sure.
Who was the female lead in that?
Oh, God. I couldn't even tell you.
I can't remember. I remember Pierce Brosnan was in it, but I can't remember who the female lead was. Oh, Rene Russo, I think. I think it was Rene Russo.
And directed by John McTiernan?
Yeah, McTiernan directed it.
That's a very odd choice.
And that was Rene Russo, right?
Yeah, Rene Russo.
Okay. In the 1970s, McQueen was one of Hollywood's highest paid actors and starred in hit films such as director Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway, which is my favorite Steve McQueen movie, with Alan McGraw, to whom McQueen was married from 73 to 78. Papillon with Dustin Hoffman, The Towering Inferno with Paul Newman, William Holden, and Faye Dunaway. In the summer of 1980, McQueen traveled to Rosarito Beach, Mexico, where he underwent an unorthodox cancer treatment that involved, among other things, coffee enemas and a therapy derived from apricot pits. On November 6th, 1980, he had surgery to remove cancerous masses from his body, and he died the following day. His final films were Tom Horn and The Hunter, both of which were released in 1980. Everybody knows The Hunter, shot right here in Chicago. Car flying out of the Marina Tower, which I vividly remember them filming that here. It was such a big deal. And then him, like, climbing around on top of the L. What was that terrible movie with, awful movie with Angelina Jolie and James McAvoy?
Oh, Wanted?
Oh.
I was really into it when it came out.
It's terrible.
I know, but I thought it was the coolest thing of all time because they curve bullets.
Oh, I just remember them jumping around on top of the L. That's the only thing I remember.
There's not really much to that movie.
No. And I love James McAvoy. I'll watch him in anything. You know? He's the only reason that I actually like an M. Night Shyamalan movie. I didn't like Glass. Glass was terrible. He was the best thing in it. He was by far the best thing in it. But I actually like Split, except for the final shot when they connect the two Unbreakable. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
My boss at the 400 threw a shoe.
At the end?
Yeah, because I said at the beginning of the picture, at the beginning of Split, I turned to my boss, Hillary, and I was like, hey, I got $20 that, what's his name? Bruce Willis shows up at the end.
No, you did?
I did. I called it, and she got so mad that she threw a shoe at the screen.
How did you call that?
I thought it was a joke. Because I'm like, oh, get it? Because Bruce Willis is in Unbreakable. Oh, yeah, Bruce. And The Sixth Sense, because I always say the twist is that it was Bruce Willis the whole time.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, yeah, wouldn't it be crazy? I bet Bruce Willis shows up in this one and it's Unbreakable.
That is hilarious.
I know. I couldn't believe it.
Hilarious. You must have lost your mind when he showed up in the end.
I know. I jumped up and everybody, no one else in the theater that was with us for the family, you know, we call it a family screening, had seen Unbreakable.
Yeah.
And so they didn't get it. They were just like, why is he in this? Is this The Sixth Sense or what is this?
There were audible moans in the theater where I saw it, where people just went, oh, and I was one of them. Because I really liked the movie. I did. I liked that movie up until that final shot. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
What's that guy's name again? That weird supervillain?
Mr. Glass.
It's just, oh, it's him. I couldn't believe it. I got the $20.
That's funny. That's really funny that you called that. That's hilarious.
It's the one time that I had that level of prescience to just be like, you know, see into the future. I was like the madman. He absolutely did it. He did it.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, that's not Split's not a great movie because he's never made a great movie. M. Night Shyamalan has never made. He's only made one good movie, and that's Split. The rest of his movies all suck. But McAvoy is phenomenal in that movie. It is such a fun performance to watch. I just think he's great. I just didn't like the Wanted. So, let's see, 50 years ago, one of the classic Steve McQueen movies came to define the King of Cool image that was released. It was Bullet, directed by Englishman Peter Yates and memorably filmed in San Francisco. It starred McQueen as the titular anti-establishment police detective Frank Bullet. See, a lot of people forget that that's actually the character's name because it's spelled differently than the ammunition.
Yeah, B-U-L-I-T-T.
Right. The film and McQueen's performance would influence the cop movie for decades and place the leading man at the top of his profession. Soon, he would become the highest-paid actor in the world. No mean feat for someone who came from a broken home, having never met a father who had left his mother when McQueen was 6 months old and who was placed in a reform school at 14. I didn't realize he had such a rough life. It is for his iconic roles in Bullet and other much-loved films, including The Magnificent Seven and The Great Escape, that he is most remembered. Not a great actor, but certainly a great movie star. Like most Hollywood legends, McQueen played variations of his own image and had a gut instinct for what worked on screen. Here is a list of the best Steve McQueen movies, and no, The Blob isn't among them.
That's a mistake. That's a mistake.
The Blob's a terrible movie.
I like it.
I mean, I watch it every time Svengoolie shows it.
Well, you have to.
Because it's The Blob, and it also has like one of the greatest theme songs in the history of movies. Completely inappropriate for the movie. It creeps and reaps and...
You can thank Burt Bacharach for that one.
Absolutely. You can thank Burt Bacharach for a lot of great stuff. So, all right, Steve McQueen fans out there, we're celebrating the guy because he was so cool and he made a lot of really cool movies, and that's what we're talking about. What are your favorite Steve McQueen performances and movies, and what are your memories about Steve McQueen on this, the anniversary of his death? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
We call it speed dating. Only because our victim had 15 dates.
Well, you know what they say, Frank. Speed kills.
Bravo, man.
You know what they say. Speed kills.
Now, I'm sure you've gone down that rabbit hole.
Oh, my God, yeah.
On YouTube. Because there's like, they have like hours of just, you know, David Caruso, the openings of CSI Miami, followed by the, yeah! Oh, man. Triple Play Thursday, man. 312-981-7200. Yeah! 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. It's Thursday morning. Here till 5. Steve McQueen passed away on this date in 1980. He was like the epitome of cool. I loved him when I was a kid growing up and thought he was just like so cool. And he made some really great movies and he appeared in some classics too. And he was sort of a legendary screen presence and a lot of really cool stuff about, we love a lot of really cool stuff about him. So you want to jump in? We're remembering Steve McQueen and some of his best movies and performances and moments. 312-981-7200. Boy, I'll tell you something. He and Ally McGraw were like in the 70s, they were like the Hollywood couple. They made the news. They were in newspapers and magazines all over the place. Their marriage was, I mean, it was like the Hollywood marriage of that time period without question. And my favorite Steve McQueen movie, as I mentioned before, is The Getaway. You've seen The Getaway?
Yeah, I own The Getaway.
Oh, man. I even like the remake with Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger.
I've never actually seen the remake.
It's good.
I'll check it out.
I mean, to me, that's hallowed ground. You know what I mean? It's Peckinpah, man. Don't be messing. But I actually thought the remake, I went in with the lowest expectations possible. I actually thought the remake was pretty good. But man, The Getaway, and you gotta love the ending of that movie. I mean, come on, man. For people, I don't want to give it away. But the final moment of that, the final scene in that movie is hilarious. It's so good. So that's my favorite Steve McQueen movie. What about you guys? 312-981-7200. Here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
You know, the movie I'm about to mention, you don't even need to be a Steve McQueen fan to like. It's The Sand Pebbles.
Yeah, terrific movie.
I thought it brought out the best, and you know, there was more depth and more dimension to McQueen as shown in that movie than people realized. I mean, he was an individual, the rebel, and not so much Mr. Cool, but you know, he was in his own element in that movie.
Yeah,
flawless.
And he got it's his only Oscar nomination too. He got nominated for an Oscar for that, and for Robert Weiss directed that movie. Yeah.
Sure. Can I briefly mention, there is another Steve McQueen movie that has been totally forgotten about. I forgot the name of it, but Steve McQueen plays a nerdy, geeky Jewish guy in the Bronx who gets picked on by the neighborhood bullies.
Oh.
Does this sound familiar to you? It was so unusual.
Was it early in his career?
Yeah, he was very skinny in that movie, or maybe he was supposed to look like it, but he gets picked on because he has to cross over to a gang territory, and one of the guys in the gang sticks up for him and makes friends with him and comes to his house and gives him boxing lessons.
Wow.
It's really funny. You got to see this movie because...
Let's see if somebody knows. Leave your radio on. We'll find out if somebody knows the name of that one. That's something I really need to see, I think. I've never seen that, so...
You got to see it.
Yeah.
It's got some other famous actors in it, and it's got a crime plot to it, too.
Okay.
He eventually becomes an attorney, and the guy that befriended him, he's got to put him in jail, ultimately, because he goes bad. But it's quite a flick.
Well, definitely check it out. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely.
All right, somebody knows the name of that movie. We would love to to get the title of that and check it out and see if it's available on your DVDs. Sounds fantastic. I would love to see that. Here's Lake Geneva Dan. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, morning, Nick. Stephen Queen's in a rather obscure early 70s movie called On Any Sunday about motorcycle racing.
Mm-hmm.
And it hooked me if you're into motorcycles, but it shows how good a dirt biker he was.
Yeah.
I mean, jumping 50 yards through the air off of sand dunes. That's how he did the scene in The Great Escape.
He could handle a motorcycle and he could handle a car, man. Have you seen Le Mans?
Oh yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah.
He was so obsessed with racing and I think it's awesome that a guy who is obsessed with who could really drive cars and motorcycles is in two movies that feature some of the most iconic car chases and motorcycle moments. Yeah, I just think that's I think that's fantastic. The moment in Great Escape is unforgettable, and the car chase and Bullet.
But it's called On Any Sunday, Nick.
Yeah, Any Sunday. Okay, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, bye.
I see him. Here's our good friend Doc. Hey, Doc.
Hey, man. You know, I would have something to say on just about anything, but Steve McQueen was born in Slater, Missouri.
Uh huh.
And I went there every day to pick up bank work for 4 years. And his parents were alcoholics. He was kind of passed around amongst relatives.
Yeah.
And for a long time, he lived with his grandparents in a 10-by-20, what they called a railroad shack. Had no running water, electricity, or an indoor toilet.
I had no idea what a rough childhood he had. No idea.
And then he went to live with his uncle, who had a 320-acre hog farm. And, you know, they asked him, what did you learn? Because a lot of people said he hated that town. And his third wife, the one he was married to when he died, said he didn't hate anything except when he ran out of beer. But they said, what did you learn by living in that town? And said, we learned what the difference between right and wrong,
yeah,
and what's fair and not fair, and the value of hard work. And then he ran away at age 14 to join a traveling circus to get away
amazing
from his family.
Unbelievable
and
story.
He was making plans to go back there and kind of settle things, smooth things out
right
about the time he died.
Right.
But here's an obscure
hold on.
Movie.
Doc, hold on. Okay, because we have to hit the news, so hold on.
Okay.
All right, Doc's going to hang on. We got some more Steve McQueen trivia and Steve McQueen talk. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. That will wrap up the Triple Play Thursday for The Who. And we got more requests coming in if you want. 312-981-7200. You have your Triple Play Thursday? That's one artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. Steve McQueen passed away on this date in 1980, so we're remembering the King of Cool, Mr. Steve McQueen. Had no idea what a rough childhood he had. We're learning all about that and talking about our favorite moments and movies and performances of Steve McQueen. And if you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Before the break, Doc was telling us some little trivia about his life. Doc, welcome back. You were just about to tell us something else about Steve McQueen.
Yeah, you know, he's one of those guys that was a movie star, and we don't have very many of them. And I kind of think of him like Gene Hackman. Whatever role you put him in, I totally believe it.
Yep.
You know, so many of these guys, they look like they're acting. And a couple of weeks ago, you were talking about movie locales, and I mentioned Junior Bonner. Man, you wouldn't make me believe he hadn't been a rodeo star his whole life.
Yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned Great Escape, but one other movie that very few people have seen that was really gritty, but with Lee Remick, Baby, the Rain Must Fall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen that one.
Yeah, that was pretty depressing, but outstanding performances by both of them.
Yeah. Now, you were going to say he went, to school somewhere? What did you say?
No, I just said that, you know, when he lived in Slater, he ran away from there at age 14 to join a circus to get out of that town.
To join a circus?
A traveling circus, yeah. It's only about 2,000 or 3,000 people about 70 miles from Kansas City.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Interesting stuff. Thanks, Doc.
All right. Great topic.
See you, buddy. Steve McQueen. We got some texts here. Steve McQueen was the best, 301 area code says. Bullet, the Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape, Papillon, The Hunter, Tom Horn. I even like the TV series Wanted Dead or Alive, which I think was a spinoff of Trackdown. 773 area code says, Bullet, best car chase ever. French Connection was also a great car chase with a train. 708 area code says, I like Cincinnati Kid when he was a poker player. Yeah, that was a good one, too. 708 area code, that's Terry, who says, Papillon, Towering Inferno, and Soldier in the Rain. 708 area code says, Steve McQueen's son was one of the main antagonists in Karate Kid. What? Really?
Hmm.
One of the main antagonists in the Karate Kid was Steve McQueen's son?
I believe it. Let's see.
What's his name? Because I know What's-His-Face is the main antagonist, the guy who was in every 80s movie as a bad guy. He plays the big jerk in Karate Kid. And I'm blanking out his name. But he was
Martin Cove.
No, not Martin Cove. Martin Cove was the guy who ran the dojo. I'm talking about the kid.
William Zabka.
Yeah, Zabka, right.
William Zabka, yeah.
But was one
Chad
of
his, McQueen.
Chad McQueen. What else has he been? Yeah, wait a minute. That I think is ringing a bell here. What else has he been in?
Let's see. Let's go back a little bit here. So yeah, Karate Kid was one of his earliest roles. He was in Hadley's Rebellion. Holy cow! He's in Fever Pitch.
Wait a minute. Who does he play in Fever Pitch?
He's just prisoner. But he is in Fever Pitch.
Wow,
that is good. Lord.
Now, we're talking about the classic 1985 worst movie ever made, Fever Pitch, with Ryan O'Neal.
Yeah.
Okay. Not the baseball movie with Jimmy Fallon.
Nope. Or the football movie with...
Yeah, with Bullethead, or whatever his name is.
Yeah, no, Fever Pitch, 1985.
Yeah.
Prisoner.
I didn't know he was in that. I've seen Fever Pitch 18,000 times.
Yeah.
It is truly the worst movie ever made. It is really, and it's also one of the most entertaining movies that you will ever see. It's unfortunately very, very difficult to find. So.
Yeah. It seems like he pretty much stopped acting in 2001.
Okay. Chad McQueen.
Chad McQueen, though. Yeah.
312 area code says, McQueen, many great movies. Best car chase ever. It holds up to this day. Ford even makes a bullet model Mustang. It's badass.
I'd buy that.
Yeah. It's a classic car chase. Here's June on WGN. Hi, June.
Hi.
Hi.
My favorite Steve McQueen movie that nobody ever talks about is the one he made with Natalie Wood. It's called Love with the Proper Stranger.
Uh-huh.
And he plays a musician who has a one-night stand with Natalie Wood, and unfortunately she becomes pregnant, and they decide that she has to have an abortion.
Wow.
Yeah. Nobody ever knows about this movie, and I have it on VHS. I bought a tape many years ago.
Wow. I mean, that sounds pretty progressive for that time period.
Especially. Yeah, it was made in 1963, I think.
Holy cow. Wow.
The scene where she sees the abortionist is very intense and disturbing, and it's always stayed with me, and I think I always thought nobody ever talks about that movie, but they were both wonderful. They had great chemistry.
Wow, that's something I definitely am interested in seeing, June. I'll definitely in love with a proper stranger. Okay. Thanks for talking about that one, June.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, see ya. Jeez. That's a movie that sounds like way ahead of its time. You know, and Natalie Wood in a movie that involves abortion and stuff, especially in 1963?
Unheard of, really.
Wow.
Unheard of at that time.
Well, here are some of the movies that Independent chose. Tom Horn, which was from 1980. That was the last movie that was released, I believe. Routine action thriller The Hunter was McQueen's final film. So it came out. They both came out the same year. But it would have been more fitting if a Western was remembered as his epitaph in much the same manner as John Wayne with The Shootist. Given McQueen had been catapulted to fame in The Magnificent Seven and had originally made his name on television with Wanted Dead or Alive, Tom Horn charts the final days and hanging for a murder he didn't commit of the Frontier legend, but it had a troubled production and met with poor reviews. The Western had gone out of fashion since The Magnificent Seven's heyday, and McQueen had been usurped by a new breed of actors with the attitude and daring he once exemplified. The film star was probably ill with the cancer that killed him when shooting Tom Horn, and his gaunt, lined face reflects this, but it fits well with the tone of the movie, a beautifully photographed, wintry, understated Western that really deserves reconsideration. Yeah, I like Tom Horn. I thought it was a good film. Yeah. So maybe check that one out. All right, and then we got Le Mans from 1971, dismissed on release as a self-indulgent vanity project. Le Mans has been favorably reevaluated of late on the back of the 2015 documentary about the making of the movie. Keen motorcycle and car racer McQueen attempted to realize a long-held ambition to make a film about motorsport and chose the famous 24-hour endurance event for his project, but it all ended disastrously for the star. Lack of a coherent storyline or script, on-set crashes, hirings, firings, and financial problems dogged the production, and the docudrama subsequently bombed at the box office. Viewed now with its spectacularly authentic racing footage and innovative camera work, Le Mans is every bit as interesting as watching a real Formula One these days.
I always liked Le Mans growing up.
Yeah.
I thought it was and I'm not much of a car guy, but if you can get exciting car action in any sort of movie, I'm in.
Well, and the thing is, it's authentic.
It absolutely.
You know, and he, that was one of his obsessions, Steve McQueen, as you know, as we've been talking about. But yeah, and I remember when Le Mans came out, it did tank. It did, and I never saw it in the theater. I don't think it was in the theater long enough for me to see it. I've never seen it in the theater. I've only seen it on TV. Now we got The Cincinnati Kid. Norman Jewison directed that in 1965, set in Depression-era New Orleans, and often unfairly dismissed as a poor man's hustler with poker replacing pool. The Cincinnati Kid has McQueen as the card shark on the rise trying to take down the man played by the great Edward G. Robinson, reigning king of the five-card stud. The Kid's love life complicates matters, but forget the romantic asides. This is all about the game, both on the card table and in the acting duel between McQueen and the all-time great Robinson. The younger man is just right in one of those roles that establishes his laconic screen persona with lots of close-ups of his famous blue eyes. But as Robinson's character says after he wipes out the young pretender in the final hand, you're good, kid, but as long as I'm around, you're second best. McQueen may have had to bow to the master on this one, but before long, he would be on the top of the pile. Yeah, Edward G. Robinson. A legend that guy was.
That's sitting on my Netflix queue right now. They just added it.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to watch it.
Yeah.
Really, really excited.
It's really good. It's really good. I don't think it's as good as The Hustler.
Well, that's one of the sweatiest movies ever made.
It's a phenomenal movie.
One of the drunkest movies ever
made. Oh, my God, they drink in that movie. I like when they're having the marathon, when he's playing Jackie Gleason and like the marathon pool session, and he just gets... Paul Newman just gets drunker and drunker and drunker as the games and the nights go, you know, like a full 24 hours. And at one point, Jackie Gleason, of course, plays Minnesota Fats, goes to the bathroom and washes his hands and fixes his hair, puts his jacket back on. He walks out, and Paul Newman just looks at him. He goes, "You look beautiful."
That's a tough performance to beat.
And George C. Scott, man. You owe me money!
He's mean in that.
He's fantastic in it.
Love it. I love it.
The thing about George C. Scott, though, is that I can't believe, I've said this a million times, I can't believe that he didn't just go straight to comedy for the rest of his career after Strangelove, because he is hilarious in Dr. Strangelove. Now, there's a lot of great performances in it. Obviously, three roles from Peter Sellers. Magnificent. To me, the funniest performance in that movie is George C. Scott. He'll see the big board. He kills me in that movie. Just the facial expression he makes while he's chewing gum when they're on the phone. He's just Buck Turgidson. Yeah, he's so funny in that movie. It is truly one of my favorite comedic performances of all time. Yeah.
Buck Turgidson.
Buck Turgidson. You're going to be Mrs. Buck Turgidson.
I don't know. There's so many great lines. I don't know if anything can really beat the gentlemen. Please, no fighting. Yeah. This is the war room.
No, I mean that's a ledge. That's you know.
Mein Führer.
Yeah,
I can walk.
I can walk. If you watch that movie next time you watch Strangelove, which I know I've only seen it about 60,000 times. During that scene where you know that final scene where Peter Sellers is struggling with his hand and. doing that whole thing. Watch the guy who's playing the Russian, because he busts out laughing. Like, he can't contain himself just standing behind him. And you see it in the shot, because if you just watch the Russian guy, when Peter Sellers is doing all that classic physical stuff and Mein Führer, I can walk and all that stuff. But if you just keep your eye on the guy who plays the Russian guy, he's struggling really hard to keep it together, which, of course, makes sense because Peter Sellers is hilarious in that scene. But, yeah, so strange love. All right, we got more Steve McQueen stuff to talk about here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 if you want to join us. And we'll get back to it right after this.
Pity me. I'm so alone and so blue. My friends have all gone away. Their friendliness too.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk or text. We're talking about Steve McQueen. It's the anniversary of his death, and we're remembering some of his best performances, some of his best movies, and we would love to hear from you. Talk or text at 312-981-7200. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. Got some more texts here about Steve McQueen. 331 area code says, Bullet was just on TV. I watched a portion of the movie. The channel Movies, with an exclamation point, aired it. Jay says, hi, Nick. I especially like the Sand Pebbles because of his scenes and issues in a tavern and Navy issues. Also, Candace Bergen is so pretty. 630 area code says, can you tell me the name of the movie he made with Jackie Gleason and a young Tuesday Well? Yeah, that's Soldier in the Rain. That's the movie's called Soldier in the Rain, which is available on DVD if you are interested. 773 says, I love the Thomas Crown Affair. Which is what we're talking about next here in this article. The Thomas Crown Affair, all style and little substance for some. Perfect put your brain in neutral entertainment for others, with McQueen as the rich, bored businessman who plots and executes a perfect bank robbery. Faye Dunaway is the glamorous insurance investigator on his trail, and an intriguing cat-and-mouse game ensues. The split-screen technology, innovative for the time, soon became over-familiar. You'll either love or hate The Windmills of Your Mind, which won the Best Song Oscar, and then there's that damn chess scene, which quickly became ripe for parody. McQueen's change of image didn't sit well with some critics either, who couldn't take him in suits and playing polo, but even with all these caveats, the original Thomas Crown Affair is still better than the 1999 remake. I agree with that completely. Next, they talk about The Sand Pebbles, directed by Robert Wise. This epic war drama, a labor of love for director Robert Wise, took 4 years from conception to finished work and was notable for veiled criticisms of American imperialism and allusions to the Vietnam War. A spectacular mix of action and romance, The Sand Pebbles features McQueen in one of his typically rebellious loner roles as a cynical mechanic aboard a U.S. gunboat patrolling China's Yangtze River in 1926, a man more in love with his engine than the human race. However, by the tragic conclusion, he's been redeemed by his love for Candace Bergen's school teacher. It's arguably McQueen's finest performance, and it was his only Oscar nomination, and proved that he was capable of greater depth than he had heretofore been given credit for. It's a terrific movie. I haven't seen that one in a long time. I got to bust that one out and watch it again. The Sand Pebbles. Really, really good. He's really good in it. Really good. Here's Larry on WGN. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, what's up?
Yeah, one thing about McQueen that I always was fascinated by was he was supposed to go to that the Manson murder house. He was supposed to go there that night to that party.
Right.
Yeah, and he met some girl and then went off with her instead. But he was supposed to be there.
Yeah, no, I know. And they kind of cover that in the Tarantino. Did you see the Tarantino movie earlier this year?
No, I didn't see that.
It's it takes place at that time, and it has somebody playing Charles Manson and somebody as Steve McQueen. And so it's mentioned in the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio movie from earlier this year. Yeah, it's in the movie.
Well, okay, so one more thing about McQueen, which is in that movie, The Cincinnati Kid.
Yeah.
It was like a thing about women in the whole movie where he was having problems with women. And then when he's dealt the cards in that game, that last game, it's a woman dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's always making references to the the Robinson character that, oh, you're pretty sick, huh? You're not feeling good, are you? This and that. In other words, she's dealing the cards to the guy, but making all these comments like he's really sick and he doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was really, he couldn't win regardless of that one.
Yeah, it's true. Very cool. Yeah. Okay, Larry, thanks, my friend.
Yep. Okay. All right, bye.
Bye. And now, in this article, we get to what I mentioned already, which is my favorite Steve McQueen movie, which is The Getaway. I just love that movie. By the late 60s, McQueen had established himself as arguably the film world's biggest superstar, but three films in a row, The Reavers, Le Mans, and Sam Peckinpah's Junior Bonner, had bombed at the box office. Junior Bonner's a terrific movie, by the way. That's another Peckinpah movie. McQueen needed a hit, and he got it when he teamed up again with Peckinpah for the role of Doc McCoy, a tough bank robber who embarks on one last job, which naturally goes badly and bloodily wrong. By all accounts, The Getaway was a chaotic shoot, with Peckinpah and some cast members spending much of the time drunk, and McQueen and leading lady Ally McGraw beginning the affair that would soon lead to their marriage. Can you imagine the amount of drinking that would happen on a Peckinpah set? With Steve McQueen there?
Oh, my God.
Could you imagine the boozing going on there?
Peckinpah
was a big drinker.
Big boozer.
Oh, my
big
God.
Big boozer.
Was his last movie The Osterman Weekend? Was that Peckinpah's last movie? You ever see The Osterman Weekend with Rutger Hauer?
I haven't seen it, but we talked about it.
You should see it. It's good. It's a weird movie, but it's good. But I think that was his last film. I'm almost positive it was his last film.
Yeah. Last film. Yeah, The Osterman Weekend.
Yeah.
The Osterman Weekend. Well, I always think of him for The Getaway, obviously The Wild Bunch.
Oh, please.
And Straw Dogs.
Oh, Straw Dogs.
That is stomach turning.
That movie is unbelievable.
And also Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. That's a fun one.
No, he directed a lot of great movies.
He's the man.
Not for the first time, Peckinpah had finished the film taken away from him, not by the studio on this occasion, but McQueen himself, as he was entitled to do under the terms of his contract. Peckinpah hated the star's finished cut, but McQueen laughed all the way to the bank, taking 10% of the film's $35 million proceeds. Violent, amoral, not easy to like, yet compulsively watchable, The Getaway put McQueen back on top, and he was the king of cool again. Yeah, no, I love that movie. I love it. It is pretty amoral, and but I still think it's great, and it's my favorite of all the McQueen movies. Hey Nick, Steve McQueen's son and grandchildren had Gas Monkey Garage rebuilt the bullet car, and they redid the scene on the streets of San Francisco, and it's on YouTube. Seriously, they recreated the scene from
Oh, all right. Good old Chad McQueen.
Chad McQueen.
Because, I mean, that was, would have been the 50th anniversary last year, because it came out in 68?
Yeah, it would have been last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to believe that movie is 50 years old. So, all right, let's take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll talk more about Steve McQueen celebrating his life. 312-981-7200 for your thoughts. Welcome back. We didn't acknowledge who requested that and who it is.
That's a little Elton John, mm-hmm. which is from David Monroe.
Okay. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. I am your overnight dude every weekday morning from 1 to 5 a.m. We've been talking about Steve McQueen. We're also going to talk about Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese has got a new movie coming out. I'm sure you guys have all heard about it. It's also going to be released on Netflix at the end of the month. It's called The Irishman, with getting incredible reviews. It's over 3.5 hours long, and it features Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci, and Harvey Keitel, among others. And it's getting incredible, incredible reviews. And so we're going to go back and look back at the Martin Scorsese movies from the past and rank them and talk about our favorite Martin Scorsese movies and scenes and all that cool stuff, because he's one of the best directors that's ever lived. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Steve McQueen passed away on this day in 1980. So we're remembering his career and some of the movies that he made and some of the performances that he gave. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. The next movie that is mentioned in the article here is Papillon. After the success of The Getaway, Papillon consolidated McQueen as the as Hollywood's biggest star, with his role as a convict determined to escape from the infamous French penal colony Devil's Island against all odds. Based on the possibly unreliable memoir of French criminal Henri Charard, Papillon finds McQueen in yet another rebel role and is harrowing, graphic, undeniably exciting, and involving. Viewers are rooting for the guy all the way through his sufferings, despite reservations about him and his crimes, and it's a testament to McQueen's performance as the survivor who will stop at nothing to regain his liberty. Did not enjoy the remake at all, which was completely unnecessary. But, what's his name? The guy who played Freddie Mercury had the Dustin Hoffman role.
Oh, yeah, that was...
Rami Malek.
Yeah, Rami Malek.
Who was the lead in the remake? I can't even remember. It was like...
Charlie Hunnam.
Oh, yeah, Charlie Hunnam. I still remember the first time I saw Charlie Hunnam was in that that soccer movie.
It's Green Street Hooligans?
Yeah, with Frodo.
God, I love Green Street Hooligans.
Oh, so do I. So good. Oh, so do I. About six people have seen that movie, though. I thought it was great. And I just remember him. I'd never seen him before, and I was like, who is this dude? So, all right. We got Bob here on WGN. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
Yeah, I had Steve McQueen bump into me when he was in town for The Hunter.
Ah.
I was an extra, went down to the set, waited all morning for him to come running down the street after this guy.
Yeah.
And then they told us to walk into the station. So I'm walking to the station toward the end of the line, and just as I was about to go through the door, somebody grabbed me from behind on both shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And it was him. And he went in. And I looked around, and like actors are, they followed their instinct and went up the stairs. So I'm standing there with Steve McQueen. He looks at me, and he says, are you okay? I said, yeah. Then he looks around and says, how do you get out of here? I said, over there. So he comes up to me and shakes my hand and says, thank you.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty cool.
And then he died a couple of months later.
He did. He died a few months later. And and then the movie turned out to be a big hit, though. The Hunter turned out to be a big hit.
But there's a part two to the story.
Uh-huh.
So years later, I go on the set of Widows. And I'm in the scene where the mother is yelling at the girlfriend because her husband got killed.
Yeah.
So we did the scene, and the shoot was over, and the director comes walking by and shakes our hand, mm-hmm. which is unusual because I've done some of these things, and no director's ever shook my hand.
Yeah.
And I looked at him, and I said, you're the second Steve McQueen I've shaken hands with.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Bob.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. By the way, he mentions Widows. That is, to me... I was so disappointed that nobody went to see that movie. I mean, I can't even explain to you how disappointed I was that nobody went to see that movie, because it's so great.
Yeah.
It's a great movie, and the performances are so good.
I remember sitting there in the theater watching it, just being like, no one's going to see this, and it's one of the movies of the year.
It, without question.
Without question.
Without question.
Cynthia Erivo.
Great, great use of our city.
Yeah, my favorite part about that movie is the fact that on the weekends, my favorite place to go get breakfast is the Golden Pancake House next to the Riviera mm-hmm. in Uptown. And they shot many scenes inside that diner, and they used the mirrors because there's pillars with mirrors.
Right.
And it's so genius. And every time I go in for breakfast, I'm just like, oh, cool. They shot widows in here.
Yeah. My friend lived two blocks away from where, you know, when they're setting on fire to the cars with a car bomb in the cars.
My
friend lives like two blocks away from there. He was outside watching him film.
And then the GN connection with Rick Pearson is thanked in the movie as being a consultant.
That's right. And I have an old friend who's in it. His name is Steve Walker. And he played the reporter questioning Colin Farrell as Colin Farrell is leaving.
And Steve, your friend Steve Walker, I met him because he came into the 400 one time when we were showing it.
Oh, he's
like, oh, yeah, I'm the reporter. I'm like, oh, nice, man.
Wow, that's cool.
Good job, Steve.
Steve, good guy, man. Good guy. Speaking of Steve's, here's another Steve. Hey, Steve.
Well, I've never even heard of that movie. I just caught the last part of that call, and I wish I heard it from the beginning.
It came and went, and it's really too bad because it's a terrific movie. It's called Widows, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, like I told your producer, I wish they would have made like a documentary about the making of the Sand Pebbles. I mean, it's a really good movie, and you know, checking out the scenes and the background and everything, and even the ship, you know, that was an interesting boat, you know.
Yeah.
And it's too bad they never made a documentary about making that movie.
I want to kind
of go off on a tangent here. I had an uncle. Okay, this guy was larger than life. He was on a gunboat like that called the Panay in the 30s. Mm-hmm. The Panay was bombed and it sunk by the Japanese in 1937. This is before we even got into war.
Yeah.
But he was on that boat, and then he got out of the Navy, came home, got into construction. When World War II started, he joined the Seabees, and he was in the South Pacific building airstrips on all these islands and stuff, and he met Pappy Boyington, you know, from Bow Bow Black Sheep.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I remember now, because every summer we used to go down to southern Indiana, and I'd spend at least a couple weeks down there. And I remember when he would have malaria, you know, outbreaks, because, you know, you never get over malaria. And he was the volunteer fire chief, fire captain, or fire chief, and you know, when I'm a little kid, you know, and he'd pull the fire truck out, you know, and I'd get to sit in it. And I mean, he was just a really cool guy, you know.
Yeah.
But every time I see the Sand Pebbles, I think of him.
Oh, there you go. All right, Steve, thanks for the call, man.
Okay,
see ya. There you go. I got some texts here, 312-981-7200. 815 area code says, in the early 70s, Steve raced pro-level motocross as Harvey Mushman to avoid the studios and fans knowing who he was. Harvey Mushman?
That's a great alias.
um, 815 area code says, the drive-up phone booth McQueen uses in The Hunter is still in Bonfield, Illinois, but no phone anymore. 920 area code says, McQueen did a musical. I forgot the name. He did a musical? Steve McQueen did a musical? Okay, I didn't know that. We'll have to look into that. 816 area code says, Nick, I can't think about The Getaway without thinking of Sally Struthers' scenes with Al Letter. Yeah. Those are classic moments. 630 area code says, another good one is Nevada Smith. Good old Steve McQueen. All right, a couple more movies mentioned here in this article, and then we'll move on. We got Harold on the phone. Go ahead, Harold.
Well?
Yeah, go ahead.
Grew up seeing The Blob, and I'm always attached to that. I think it's great. I know it's a low-budget film, but I think they did a lot with hardly any budget. And, I mean, you know, throughout the movie, as it goes, he really does convince you that he's scared that this thing is going to kill everybody in the town if they don't do something about it. And the other movie is somebody just mentioned Nevada Smith. I never seen that movie and I was at work, and somebody was telling me about it. And one guy that worked with us had read the book, and he told me some of the insights that they only kind of allude to. They told me a little bit about that, so I had to see that movie. And it's kind of a morality tale. If anybody hasn't seen it, you know, he's out for vengeance for the people that the people that have killed his family.
Right.
And he kills them all, and then at the end, he's got one left to get, is Carl Malden, but he had basically caused the death inadvertently of a girl that he fell in love with, who, you know, because he was using her to get out of prison.
Right.
And she basically was so let down by him that she just told him to just leave her alone and let her die. And at the end, he's got Carl Malden. Carl Malden can't escape, and he just can't forget what she said. And then he just basically lets him go.
Yeah.
And then he shoots him in the kneecaps. Well, I guess you're getting kneecaps at least, but then I'll let you live.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a Nevada Smith is a good film, and it had a great cast: Carl Malden, Brian Keith, Arthur Kennedy, the beautiful Suzanne Pleshette, also in that movie. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Harold. Okay, the next ones that they mentioned here, The Magnificent Seven, which we talked about, an unforgettable Elmer Bernstein score, terrific action, wonderfully staged set pieces, the introduction of James Coburn's character in the famous gun versus knife duel, for example, all add up to one of the westerns that defines the genre. Yul Brynner was supposed to be the star of this remake of Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, but apparently no one had told McQueen, that famous supporting cast of stars-to-be. It was McQueen who stands out. Director John Sturges, one of the most underrated western specialists, recognized McQueen was the real deal and allowed him to build up his part. His shameless scene stealing, think of the opening sequence on the hearse as he shakes the shotgun bullets against his ear and shields the sun with his hat, infuriated Brynner, but ensured all eyes were on him and not the leading man. The King of Cool was on the rise at that point. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the discussion about Steve McQueen. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Welcome back. Elton John here on Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. We're talking about Steve McQueen and his best performances and most memorable movies. He passed away on this date in 1980. Coming up after the 3:30 news, we're going to jump into the world of Martin Scorsese. His new movie, The Irishman, opens in theaters this weekend, and it will appear on Netflix at the end of the month. And so we're going to go through his career and rank all of his movies, and we want to hear from you guys. What are your favorite Martin Scorsese movies? What are the best? Which ones do you remember the most? He's made a ton of movies, and most of them pretty great. So we'll get to that right after the news. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Wrapping up the discussion about Steve McQueen. The next one mentioned in this article is The Great Escape. McQueen was reunited with Magnificent Seven's director John Sturges, along with Charles Bronson and James Coburn, for the daddy of all POW movies. Based on the true story of Allied prisoners of war planning a mass escape from a German prison camp, the jauntiness of much of the film jars with the grim reality of the executions of the many real-life escapees on whose the story the movie is drawn from. However, this much-loved blockbuster remains one of the most famous films ever made as a perennial holiday staple. The Great Escape boasts a stellar international cast, some of whom, Donald Pleasence included, had been prisoners of war. Nobody tops McQueen, however, as Hilt's The Cooler King, the defiant American flyer who spends much of his time in solitary after his constant attempts to escape end him with him being recaptured. The enduring image of the film, of course, is McQueen's famous ride for freedom on the British Triumph 650 motorbike. Don't let the fact that this model wasn't built in the 60s spoil your enjoyment. Until the 60s, spoil your enjoyment, which has entered movie lore with McQueen performing many of his own stunts. Director Sturges knew a good thing when he saw it, and in his own words, gave McQueen the camera. And that perhaps sums up the appeal of his leading man. It may be a cliche, but the camera really did love him. And then as they pick in this article, the number one Steve McQueen movie, and I think most people would agree with this, is Bullet. McQueen is on the right side of the law for once, but still remains the outsider, the anti-hero Frank Bullet, a template for the maverick cop that would dominate for decades to come from Dirty Harry on. McQueen was reluctant to take the role initially, but eventually made the film under his short-lived production company. Despite the well-constructed plot, Bullet butts heads with an ambitious politician over an assignment to guard a criminal witness. Like so many McQueen's films, Bullet has become famous for one scene in particular, and in this case, it's the much-imitated 10-minute car chase through various San Francisco locations, which has rarely, if ever, been bettered, with McQueen famously doing much of the driving in the iconic green Ford Mustang GT. It is the film that best demonstrates McQueen's minimalist acting style, favoring a look or a gesture over reams of dialogue. Bullet was also the film that, along with The Thomas Crown Affair, saw McQueen become a late 60s style icon, roll neck sweaters and all. And there's also a splendidly atmospheric jazzy score by Lalo Schifrin. 50 years on, Bullet is still a raw, urgent vibrancy, and McQueen's ice-cold performance still impresses. Is Bullet McQueen's greatest film? I think so, but feel free to disagree, the writer says.
Yeah. That score is something else. Lalo Schifrin's just...
Oh, it's great.
Man.
It's great. It's great. 847 area code says, huge McQueen fan. I get into debates. To me, there are only three cool actors, McQueen, Bogart, and Eastwood. Yeah, there's more than that, I think. But those guys are great. So The Towering Inferno is a movie that I love. I love The Towering Inferno. Those disaster movies from the 70s, you know, they followed the same pattern, all of them. You know, they had the same, even the movie posters were the same. They would depict whatever, you know, whatever disaster was happening, and then all of the stars would be, like, their headshots would be in boxes on the bottom, all the way across, because they would always have the big all-star casts. To have Steve McQueen and Paul Newman in the same movie is pretty awesome, in The Towering Inferno. That's pretty awesome. And I don't know, I can't remember who got top billing, but they had a big fight about it, about who was going to get top billing. I think Paul Newman gets top billing, if I'm not mistaken. But those disaster movies from the 70s, man, those are of a very specific time and place. And I was always a big fan of them, always. And The Towering Inferno is, I think, one of the better examples of it. And of course, it's really long, and there's 9,000 stars in it. And, you know, you couldn't make a disaster movie in the 70s without having George Kennedy in it. George Kennedy's in, like, all of them.
Mm-hmm. So for top billing, does that mean your name is listed first or highest? Then Steve McQueen gets top billing.
Steve McQueen got top billing.
Yeah, and like you said, all the faces in the posters.
Yeah, no, all of those, if you go back and look at those 70s disaster movies, all of the posters were designed exactly the same way, with all the big stars, you know, with their heads in boxes, pictured all the way across the bottom of the poster. If you go back and look at any of those disaster movies from the 70s, that was a fun period of time at that time. I mean, there was a disaster movie come out every couple of weeks, where there'd be another disaster movie. You know, they made like five airport movies. Poseidon Adventure was one of the most popular of all time. They had everything. I mean, and even, you know, Irwin Allen was the guy who produced these movies and was basically known as the creator of the disaster movie genre. And he was definitely like the king of the disaster movie genre, Irwin Allen. He would produce all these movies. But it was fun. And, you know, Steve McQueen and Paul Newman both in Towering Inferno. So very cool stuff. But yeah, Steve McQueen, man, one and only. He was something. So, all right, why don't we take a break here, and then when we come back after the news, we're going to talk about Martin Scorsese and his career. We got an article here from Vulture.com where they rank every single Scorsese movie. So I want to talk about that. There are, on this list, there are 29 movies. That's a pretty good filmography, and we're going to go through all of them and talk about that. We want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. Talk and text for Martin Scorsese topic after the news. everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio on a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Who requested that there?
So that is coming to us from listener who goes by RDL. I'm guessing initials there. And the band is called Ovlov.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And if you want to get through to us, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Legendary director Martin Scorsese has a new film coming out this weekend, an epic gangster film with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Joe Pesci called The Irishman. And it's getting incredible reviews. And this is a big one. It's 3.5 hours long. It's going to be in the movie theaters for a few weeks, and then it's going to come on Netflix. It's always exciting when Scorsese releases a new movie. It always is, especially something like this, especially something with De Niro, Pacino, and Joe Pesci. This is a big deal. Martin Scorsese's made some of the best movies of all time, and he's certainly considered one of the great film directors that's ever lived. And so Vulture.com wrote an article where they ranked every Martin Scorsese movie from worst to best. And so we're going to go through that, and I want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200 for Martin Scorsese. Now, Scorsese's been in the news lately because he was talking a little trash about comic book movies and superhero movies and stuff, and he caught a little flack for that. I don't agree with what he said, because I think I think some of the comic book movies are really great, and many of them are very entertaining. And it takes, I think, skill as a filmmaker to make some of these. I think Logan is one of the best movies, that I've seen in a few years, and that's a comic book movie.
Yeah,
and I like Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi. That's one of my favorites.
Right,
that's a beautifully made movie.
I think what he was trying to get at, somewhat ineloquently, or maybe he just didn't have enough time in his initial statements. He got the opportunity to write an op-ed for the New York Times, which clarified how he felt. And I didn't agree with everything he said. But I think what he was trying to get at was there's this sort of movie by committee that's happening a lot.
Yeah.
And I'd be the first one to say that there's some really great superhero movies out there. I'm a big fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff by James Gunn.
Me too.
And James Gunn does not make a movie by committee.
No. Nope.
He makes exactly what he wants to make. But
you look at Slither.
Yeah.
Which is a movie adore that movie.
It's just a bee sting. Yeah.
I love that movie.
But he comes out of Troma. You know, he's a total genre guy. But there's a lot of stuff in some of the Marvel movies that are just kind of part of the machine.
Yeah.
A lot of action scenes are actually completely done by second unit, which is kind of weird when you have some really great talent. Like, who's the guy behind Black Panther? It's escaping.
Ryan Coogler.
Amazing director.
Yeah.
Amazing. He can shoot action, too. Look at Creed.
Yeah.
Some of the best boxing I've ever seen in a movie.
Creed was one of those movies that blindsided me.
Absolutely.
Like, I went in there going, all right. You know, like, I was just thinking, oh, God, it's another, we get Rocky again.
Mm-hmm.
That movie is great. And the second one's good, too. But the first one?
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere, one of my favorite films of that year, and also the second best Rocky movie.
Right.
Without question, the second best Rocky movie. And Coogler's a great director.
He
did a great job with Black Panther.
But my point is that a lot of the action stuff in Black Panther, second unit, he didn't get to touch it.
Yeah.
And which is sad, because the rest of the movie is really, really well done. But there are some action sequences in that were clearly pre-visualized, done a lot of CGI. So I think that's what Scorsese's trying to nip at.
Yeah.
While he's not quite getting there. It's nice that someone of immeasurable influence in the cinematic community, is saying something about it. And that maybe it will convince Marvel and Disney, it might be doubtful, to change their tune on letting directors be directors.
Yeah.
And it's a group effort. Scorsese knows that.
Yeah.
But you got to have some sort of unifying vision, and it probably shouldn't be from a boardroom.
Well, I agree with you. And those are issues that I think a lot of people have with commercial cinema in general. But specifically, there's a superhero movie like every weekend.
Right.
Almost. And, you know, my dad's sick of them. I can't see another super, you know, like every time, because we go to the movies every Saturday.
Sure.
And sometimes we end up seeing, you know, a superhero movie because inevitably that's like one of the big movies that opens. So we go. And my dad's like, after every superhero movie, he's like, how many more of these are there going to be?
Yeah. And I barely made it through Endgame, not because I thought it was bad or anything. I was just like, okay, I feel like I've seen a lot of it. But you mentioned Logan, which is a great example of what happens when you buck the studio. The
Absolutely.
Studio did not want to make a rated R Logan movie. James Mangold wanted to do that for years.
Yeah.
And then when they finally let him do it, he made an amazing character piece.
A great movie. A great movie. And it's a comic book movie, obviously.
Totally.
But it's also, it feels like a Western and a drama more than anything else. And the performances were so good in that movie. Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart, and I'm forgetting the little girl's name, but all three of them were unbelievable in that movie. And I cried at the end. I don't cry at comic book movies. Although when Spider-Man disappeared in, what the hell was the Infinite
the Spider-Verse?
No. Thanos hit
Endgame. Or not Endgame, it was the Infinity War.
Infinity War. Yeah. When Spider-Man disappeared, I was like, ooh. I was a little sad. Yeah.
So there's a lot of good stuff to be done.
Yeah.
There's Tom Holland is a great rising star in that. Robert Downey Jr. has revitalized his entire career by doing those movies.
But Scorsese caught the ire of the fanboys, though, this past week.
Oh, he did.
And I mean, you know, the internet, that's what it's made for. And the internet is made to yell about things that, you know, that aren't really that important. And, you know, going after Scorsese last week, all the fanboys went after him.
I just wish they would open their ears a little bit, and instead of saying, well, what does he know? He's an old man. I'm like, well, he also is like a multi-generational filmmaker.
If you dismiss Martin Scorsese, you do not know film. That's it. Period. He's one of the greatest directors that's ever lived. And everybody, I look forward to, I can't wait to see The Irishman. I don't care it's 3.5 hours long. I couldn't care less. I can't wait to see it, and I think it's going to be fantastic. I'm going on a Friday morning at 11 a.m. That's how excited I am about it.
Go get some lunch afterwards.
Man, no, it'd be dinner time afterwards. So we're talking Scorsese movies. What are your favorites? Here's the little introduction that Vulture.com put together. When Martin Scorsese decided he wasn't going to be a priest, his reasons were simple. I began to think this vocation I had was for the wrong reasons. It shouldn't be about you, he explained to Richard Schickel in the excellent book Conversations with Scorsese. It should be about others. Plus, growing up with asthma and unable to play sports, he wasn't sure he wanted a life that would add to his isolation. It was going to be about cutting myself off from the world, he said, about becoming a man of the cloth, not being a participant in it. In the best sense, Scorsese's movies have always been about him, passionately, deeply personal works that catalog his hang-ups, his obsessions, riffing on religion, spiritual torment, guilt, and the difficult road to transcendence. Often through gangster pictures and crime dramas, and although he remains one of the most movie-obsessed of all directors, his films rarely feel like the work of a man cut off from the world. Quite to the contrary, they're fully engaged with their specific milieus, whether Tibet or Little Italy. His movies feel alive, inviting, even when his characters are mobsters or monsters. They work. It's the work of a true believer. That devotion inspires an equally rapturous following. And as such, it's probably best to warn you that our rankings of Scorsese films will not perfectly overlap with your own list, because his films are always made with care and a near religious fervor. Even his weakest have their selling points. He has as many classics as overlooked masterpieces, and no two people will agree on which is which. So as The Irishman prepares to hit theaters and IMAX and Netflix in November, we bring out his movies. So they're going to rank them. There's 28 of them, or 29 of them. And now, before we get to this, Tom, do you have a favorite Scorsese movie?
I've got a favorite, and I've got what I think is his best.
Oh, well, okay. All right, I can understand that. I can see the difference. All right, first of all, let's go with your favorite.
My favorite is The Departed.
What?
I know. I love it. I love it. I think it's such a bat crap crazy movie. So much goes down.
I enjoy the hell out of it. I just don't think it. I mean, he, you know, I mean, God bless the Academy. They finally gave the guy an Oscar, but not for that movie.
I know. But I, in terms of Scorsese movies I've seen the most number of times, it's The Departed.
God, are you kidding me?
I know.
Wow.
I know.
That's weird, man.
I get so riled up whenever I see it, if it's on TV or something, yeah. And I own it.
No,
and if I see it's on TV,
listen,
I get
I've seen it a few times, you know, but it's not one of my go-tos. Definitely not one of my go-tos for Scorsese. All right, now, so that's your favorite, but what do you think is the best?
Best movie ever made was Raging Bull.
Mm.
I cannot believe how good Raging Bull is. And I know Taxi Driver's nipping at the heels, but Raging Bull is just unreal. And his use of black and white is superb.
Yeah. My favorite is Taxi Driver. I can't measure how much I love that movie and how it gets to me every time I watch it. There's not a better movie made about isolation and loneliness than Taxi Driver. And I think it's the best New York movie ever made of that specific time. And the performances are just superlative. I love that movie. I mean, truly, truly love it. I love every frame of it. I could watch it every day. And there are things about it that are just so beautiful and so subtle. I mean, the scene in the movie where that just makes me go nuts every time is when, you know, Peter Boyle plays Wizard in it, and he's like this, he's like the father figure of these taxi drivers, telling all kinds of stories, and he's supposed to have the most experience, and he knows everything, and he's got the wisdom of all the hackers, and so. When De Niro goes to the restaurant and then goes outside and tells Peter Boyle, hey, I got some bad things in my head right now. And he's trying to communicate what's going on. Like, man, I think I'm losing it. I don't know if I can take this anymore. I might do something bad. And he's trying to express this to Peter Boyle. And Peter Boyle just gets really dismissive. He's like, I don't know. What do I know? You know, go find a girl. Go get a drink. And he offers no. That's the only time in the movie where Travis Bickle reaches out and acknowledges there's something really bad happening inside his head. And that scene kills me every single time I watch it. Every single time. So my favorite is Taxi Driver. Tom's favorite is The Departed, but he thinks that Raging Bull is the best. Where do you guys stand on Scorsese? We're going to talk read this and rank his movies. There are 29 of them here in this article, and we'll start at the bottom and go up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Scorsese's movie comes out tomorrow, and I can't wait to see it. Pretty cool. What's the name of this band again?
Ovlov. O-V-L-O-V. I'm digging this.
Yeah, no, that sounds cool.
Very good triple play this morning.
Nice. Turning this on to a new band. I like the sound of that. That sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like 90s to me. A little Dinosaur Jr. kind of a feel to it, which is always good.
Oh, yeah.
Always good.
Big mood.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And also next, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. Martin Scorsese, the legendary filmmaker, has a new movie coming out, and it's always a cause for excitement. And this is particularly exciting. It's a 3.5-hour gangster epic about Jimmy Hoffa and the mob, and it stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci and Harvey Keitel, to mention a few. It's always cause for excitement when Scorsese releases a new movie. But they're ranked here. Vulture ranked them. I do not agree with the one that they put at the bottom of the list. The one that they put at the bottom of the list, and I can understand why, is Boxcar Bertha. Gene Siskel, who was prone to flights of moral panic about violence in movies, was disgusted with Boxcar Bertha, calling it trashy. Scorsese's second movie is a little trashy, we suppose, compared to what he'd do later. But considering this was a Roger Corman production, trash was the point, and what Scorsese is trying to work around. It's a noble effort and features a terrific lead performance by a then 23-year-old Barbara Hershey. But it was essentially an audition reel for Scorsese to show what he could do when he makes a real movie. I think Boxcar Bertha is pretty an interesting film. I really do. It's not one of his best. There's no question about it. But for me, if I were going to put one at the bottom of the list, it's Cape Fear. I hate that movie. That's shocking. I truly hate it. And it's the only Martin Scorsese movie that I actively dislike. Now, there are some that I don't like very much and some that I think are flawed, but I can't stand Cape Fear. I just can't stand it. And I was so disappointed.
And you like the original Cape Fear, though?
Oh, absolutely.
That's, oh my God.
Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, Robert Mitchum. Yeah. One of the scariest men of all time.
Absolutely.
I don't mind the remake.
I think he's scarier. Quite frankly, I think he's scarier than Night of the Hunter.
Well, Night of the Hunter is just...
And that's the movie that they basically ran Charles Laughton out of Hollywood after he made that movie. It was the only movie he ever directed.
Yeah, despite the fact that it is a flipping masterpiece.
Oh, my God. It's a great film.
That's a movie that influenced Scorsese.
Yeah.
You can tell.
No question. But yeah, I would definitely put Cape Fear at the bottom. Definitely. Next on the list, they put near the bottom, Shine a Light, which is the Rolling Stones movie. This concert film is slight. It doesn't even benefit from capturing the moment in musical history like The Last Waltz. But Scorsese has always been, he's always used music beautifully in his movies. Yeah. And Last Waltz is one of the definitive concert films of all time.
Yeah. And of course he was going to make a Rolling Stones thing. He uses the Rolling Stones in like every,
yeah,
it's like a joke at this point that,
yeah,
you're gonna hear the Rolling Stones probably I don't know.
Well, in the Departed, he plays it like 9,000 times in the
yeah,
Departed.
A bunch of Gimme Shelter, yeah, in the Departed.
Next on the list is New York, New York. I would put that pretty low on the list too. New York, New York is a deeply flawed movie, and after the revelation that was Taxi Driver, critics and audiences were initially baffled that Scorsese's follow-up would be an old-timey musical tribute to the golden days of Hollywood. New York, New York was famously a massive flop, and one that Scorsese has long attributed to his collapse into cocaine addiction. But seen years later, Marty could have taken it easier on himself. The movie is spotty and odd and never really gels into a coherent whole, but it's still fun, full of enrapturing moments, and it feels more like in keeping with Scorsese's career today than it did on the heels of Taxi Driver. New York, New York is obviously lower tier Scorsese, but a first-time filmmaker had made this, you'd have called him a budding genius. That's a good point. Yeah, I was never really crazy about New York, New York, and I did think it was kind of an odd follow-up to Taxi Driver, but he's admitted this, he was doing a lot of blow at that time. Yeah, I mean, and like he admitted it, like when they were doing The Last Waltz, he and Robbie Robertson were just out of their minds on coke.
Of course.
So, next they put The Color of Money. I like The Color of Money.
I think that's a little low. I think The Color of Money's pretty good.
I do too. I mean, it's not as good as The Hustler, but
no.
You know, I think there's great stuff in it. It ended up winning Paul Newman his long overdue Oscar, and the film often feels like it exists largely for that reason. The Color of Money feels slicker and more self-consciously mainstream than we're used to from Scorsese. For good reason, the project was Newman's, not Scorsese. And as is the case, he would ever be a hired gun. It's the only time he had ever done. He had gone in that direction for his career. Thank God he didn't. He would have been brilliant at it. The movie is crackerjack entertainment. Scorsese brings life to a familiar story of a generally conventional narrative. The movie feels like Scorsese impersonating a lesser but still talented filmmaker, which makes it disorienting to watch, if not necessarily unpleasant. And this remains the only Scorsese film to receive two thumbs down from Siskel and Ebert.
Wow.
That's unfair. It's a very entertaining movie.
Well, I love going back and watching Siskel and Ebert do their reviews,
yeah,
on YouTube. And
I watched them review. Just the other night, I watched them before the show. I watched them review Carpenter's The Thing, and they trashed it.
Yeah, but I've watched their one for Color of Money, and I get what they're saying, but it just I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with it.
No, I think it's a terrific movie.
It's fun. It's
and
not
everybody
best,
in it is
fun.
Really good. Tom Cruise is great in it. Paul Newman is great in it. It's a very good movie, and it's really slickly shot. So, all right, we're going to hit the news here, and then after the news, we will talk more Scorsese. We want to hear from you. Talk or text at 312-981-7200.
A Monday warrior, mean strike. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean cry.
Yeah. Yeah, man, Rush. Triple Play Thursday continues, man. Who requested the Rush? Canadian Bill?
No, it's coming to us from the 815.
Ah, okay.
I hear a little Rush.
Yeah, man. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Phone lines are open. Text lines are open. 312-981-7200. It's always an event when Martin Scorsese releases a movie, especially when it's a 3.5-hour gangster movie with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Joe Pesci, and that's exactly what The Irishman is. So we're going back and looking back at Martin Scorsese's movies and ranking them. The next one on the list comes in at number 25 is his short from New York Stories, which I love. The other two sucked. The Woody Allen one sucked, and the Coppola one sucked. But Scorsese's was great, and Nolte's fantastic in it. A filmmaking exercise featuring three shorts about characters in New York City by three of the most accomplished American directors of all time, is Scorsese, Coppola, and Woody Allen. It ends up playing like a competition between the three, and Scorsese wins rather handily. Yeah, no question about it. His story of a passionate, self-destructive painter, played by Nick Nolte, whose work is fueled by romantic discord with a series of younger tempestuous lovers, is a little problematic today, but Scorsese's comfort with the material is self-evident. Next, he brings out Bringing Out the Dead. Yeah, I would rank that a little bit low. I think Cage is great in it. But it's kind of like, you know what Bringing Out the Dead kind of plays like? It plays like Scorsese's greatest hits.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, he's done these themes like 8 million times before, yeah. And he just kind of combines them all into one movie. And
yeah, I just really like the concept. I put it a little bit higher just on personal enjoyment, but I think Bringing Out the Dead is a worthwhile trip, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, and like you said, Cage is great in it. I think he really handles the material.
Oh, no, he's great. Cage is really, really good in it. The Rolling Thunder Review, which is Scorsese's other 2019 Netflix film, is a pseudo-documentary about Bob Dylan's notorious 1975 concert tour that Dylan himself once wrestled into a mostly unwatchable fictional film called Rinaldo and Clara. Scorsese uses the footage of the tour, which is still breathtaking 40 years later, and splices into a series of interviews with Dylan and other members of the tour. Along with, it turns out, various actors, including Sharon Stone, playing entirely fictional characters supposedly connected to the tour. Scorsese has a grand time playing around with Dylan's messing with the legend aesthetic, even if Scorsese is not at heart much of a prankster. But he does find the soul of the tour, and intriguingly even Dylan, with an ending that will come out of nowhere to surprise you with its warmth and even if its triumph. So that's pretty low. They also rank Kundun, which is a movie I love.
Yeah, that's a little, what number is it at?
22.
22? Come on.
I think Kundun is a beautiful movie. Absolutely beautiful movie. Roger Deakins shot that movie. He didn't work with Roger Deakins very often. Philip Glass did the score. It's about the Dalai Lama in different parts of his life. And I think it's a beautiful film. I remember when it came out, everybody was like, what's he doing?
Well, it is very kind of strange.
Yeah. Yeah. We got some texts coming in. Everybody has a favorite Scorsese movie. Alan from Detroit says, King of Comedy is his most underrated film. Got mediocre reviews at the time, but it's one of his very best. I totally agree with that. I think King of Comedy is a great film. And I remember when it came out, it tanked. People hated it. Because it was that was his follow-up to Raging Bull. Like, he had all this incredible success with Raging Bull, all this critical acclaim and everything. De Niro wins the Oscar, and then they follow it up with King of Comedy, one of the most abrasively irritating characters in the history of film.
Rupert Pupke.
And a really uncomfortable movie to watch. I mean, I've seen it 8,000 times, and every time I watch it, that scene where they just show up at Jerry Lewis's summer home uninvited, I can't, it's difficult for me to watch.
It's unsettling.
It's so good. But yeah, I love King of Comedy. And I think in retrospect, people now love it. But when it came out, man, oh my God.
Yeah, it's definitely got a reevaluation.
Oh yeah. No. People, and it's also a great companion piece to Taxi Driver. It really is. And two wildly different performances by De Niro. De Niro's great in King of Comedy. He's great. And so is Jerry Lewis, man. Jerry Lewis is so good. You know, he improvised some of the, obviously Scorsese allows improvisation. And so that scene where they're in the summer home, De Niro says, well, we didn't mean to do anything wrong. So did Hitler, is what Jerry Lewis screams at him. That was improvised. And apparently Scorsese busted out laughing when he said it. 815 area code says, is the Pickwick Theater the only one playing the Irishman on the 22nd? Well, the Irishman opens at the Landmark, at the two Landmark theaters. The Landmark Century in Chicago, and the Landmark Renaissance. Those are the only two theaters it's opening in now.
And when it comes to the 22nd, I believe it will be on Netflix by that point.
27th it hits 27th, Netflix.
27th,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. 312 area code says, I have to agree with you about Taxi Driver. I still have the VHS tape from years ago. Yeah, man. Taxi Driver on VHS. 815 area code says, your thoughts on Shutter Island. Personally, I loved it. Super creepy, mind-plucking psychological horror. I love Shutter Island. I love it.
Yeah. It took me a while to really enjoy it. I ended up reading the book, too. It's Dennis Lehane.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I've not read the book, but I love the movie.
Yeah, the movie was really good. Nice little cameo from Robert De Niro as well.
And also, Elias Koteas, who's an actor that I love, he's creepy as hell in it. It's a creepy movie. It's a genuinely creepy movie.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, everybody's like, oh, the twist ending. I don't even see it as a twist ending. Because I knew what was happening. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a big surprise M. Night Shyamalan twist ending. I figured it out.
He lays the groundwork.
No question about
it. It's more of a slow realization. Yeah. By the time you're kind of in the middle of it, you're like, oh my God, this is really something else.
Yeah. And DiCaprio's great in it.
Yeah.
DiCaprio's great in, you know, he works very well with Martin Scorsese. And, but yeah. So the next one, number 21, is Who's That Knocking at My Door? Which is his first movie. I like it, you know, it's a first movie, but you could see where it was going. Number 20, and I would rank this much higher, Hugo. I love that movie. I love that movie. When it came out, I said it was his best movie since Goodfellas. I absolutely love that film. It's a movie about movies, and you could just feel the joy that he put into that film. And everybody is so good in it. Even Sacha Baron Cohen is great in it. And it really was beautiful in 3D. Like, it was one of those movies that I'm glad that I saw in 3D. It loses a bit. But it came out at the zenith of the 3D craze just 2 years after Avatar, but Scorsese made sure to put his own stamp on the format. Hugo is dizzying and playful in a way that Scorsese likes to indulge from time to time. I love it. I would rank that one much higher. Coming in at number 19, Gangs in New York. That's about right. I like Gangs in New York. I don't love it.
It's fine.
But I think, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis is unbelievable in it.
Daniel Day-Lewis steals the show.
Completely. I don't understand the casting of Cameron Diaz. That's the one that confounds me every time. I just don't get it.
And I really don't know what that, you know, I don't know what that movie's about. Like, I know what the plot is. I know generally what the themes are, but I didn't really feel anything after it. Like, anything profound had happened, even though it's a pretty long movie.
It is a very long movie.
I was just like,
it also features a really great song by U2. Mm-hmm. Really, one of my favorite U2 songs. Is in the soundtrack for that movie. Nick, I was thinking about Scorsese's acting in Taxi Driver. That scene is incredible. That scene is incredible. It's just so wrong on every level. His rapid-fire staccato delivery was something. I was wondering if that was his only turn at acting. Then I saw number 34 for acting on his IMDb. Sometimes he appears as himself. Other small appearances, including brothel patron and Boxcar Bertha. You know, he's actually in Taxi Driver twice. Do you remember the other time he's in it?
No, it's not ringing a bell.
Okay. Okay, so obviously he's the patron in the back seat of the car who's going to kill his wife, which is a really insanely creepy scene, and Scorsese's great in it. But he's also on the street, sitting in front of a bank with a Columbia Pictures t-shirt on. He's sitting there as Travis Bickle is walking past him. And it's one of those montage scenes where Travis Bickle is writing a letter. They cannot touch her. You know that part where they cannot? That's right there. He's walking past in slow motion, and Scorsese's just sitting there, and he just kind of turns around and looks at him.
Huh.
Yeah. So he's in it twice. He's in Taxi Driver. So I don't know if it's the same guy. I don't know if he plays the same character. I like to think it's the same character.
Yeah. I didn't know he was in Quiz Show.
Yeah. Yeah. How about his cameo in King of Comedy?
Oh yeah,
he's hilarious in that.
Oh jeez,
he plays the director of the Jerry Langford Show. I think it's funny when they're talking about the bad material, the bad joke. He goes, I think it's funny. Yeah, he's appeared in a bunch of movies. Scorsese. He's in The Muse. He's hilarious in The Muse, the Albert Brooks movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's absolutely hysterical in that movie. So he's appeared in his own movies. He's appeared in some other people's movies, too. But he's made appearances on screen. All right, Martin Scorsese Talk continues, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. What are your favorite Scorsese movies? And we'll continue to go through the rankings here of all of his movies on the eve of the release of The Irishman, which all Scorsese fans are really looking forward to. Oh, a deep cut. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m., and Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. I forgot to do the weather before we took a break there. So here's your weather for the morning and the day and Friday and Saturday and Sunday and Monday. How about that? Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, light snow, possibly mixed with freezing rain early, and then mostly cloudy. It'll be high in the mid to upper 40s and a low in the upper 20s, and we'll get some increase in wind. For tomorrow, early morning sun, and then we'll have afternoon clouds. It'll be unseasonably cold again with a high in the low 30s. For Saturday, partly sunny, warmer, high around 50, clouding up overnight with a brief shower. On Sunday, mostly cloudy, becoming windy, brief showers possible, high in the low 40s, chance of light snow or flurries overnight. And then on Monday, mostly cloudy, windy, and cold. We could have a record low max temp for the day in the middle 20s with wind chills in the teens. Cloudy, light snow, and flurries possible overnight. It's currently 28 degrees at O'Hare. It's 30 at Midway, 31 at the lakefront. All right, let's get back to it. Martin Scorsese's got a movie coming out, and it's always an event, and it's always great. And it's The Irishman, and we're all looking forward to it. And we want to hear from you guys. What are your favorite Martin Scorsese movies? 312-981-7200. The next one on the list is coming in at number 18 is Silence, which is a movie I actually like. I don't love, but I like. Scorsese had essentially been attempting to make Silence for his entire career, and watching it, you can see why he had such difficulty talking anyone into giving him money to make it. The movie is a long, grueling journey of faith and pain about two priests, Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver, on their own journey of faith and pain. Silence is about enlightenment born of strife and torture, and it can feel that way at times, which is Scorsese's intent. But where it lands and where we all end up in the story with the emergence of the priest mentor played by Liam Neeson, it is a terrific, it becomes a terrific movie.
Yeah, that was required viewing for us when we were in college.
Silence?
Because I went to Loyola, and it's a Jesuit school.
Sure.
Go Blurs.
Yeah.
Come on now.
Next, coming at number 17, The Last Temptation of Christ. I love this movie. I love The Last Temptation of Christ. It's also probably my favorite music score of all time.
Yeah, little Peter Gabriel.
It's such a great score. I would rank Last Temptation much higher. Much higher than 17.
For the controversy alone.
I mean, I just thought it was great. It's a beautiful movie. The blasphemy heard round the world with this adaptation of Niko Kazantzakis' that novel dared to depict Jesus as a deeply human individual filled with pre-natural kindness and humility, but also tempted to abandon his holy mission and run away with Mary Magdalene, played by Barbara Hershey. The Last Temptation of Christ is, to date, Scorsese's only collaboration with Willem Dafoe, who would seem like an ideal actor for the director's impassioned, tortured aesthetic. Nevertheless, Dafoe made this one count, playing Jesus as a mortal who aspires to live up to God's image. He wanted to bring it back into the body of a man, and I felt like I was ready to do that, Dafoe said later about Scorsese's take on Christ. And while the film has its weaknesses and uninspired segments, what comes through is the director's genuine spiritual searching, his deep admiration for the momentousness of Jesus's quest. Plus, it has one of Scorsese's most moving finales, a true reckoning. It's a beautiful ending. It's overwhelming, actually. It is a. It is the final. The final words. It is accomplished. It's just a. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. And you know, it's funny because he was accused of blasphemy. You know, when the movie came out, people were protesting it without having seen it. But the movie is deeply spiritual, and he's a full on Catholic, and the take on Jesus, you know, it's a fascinating take, but it's also not offensive at all. You know what I mean? It's got a beautiful ending that ends the way that Christians, you know, how Christians feel and believe. It's not at all blasphemous. In fact, it's a deeply beautiful spiritual movie. And man, Defoe is great in it.
Oh, that's a top 10 performance.
He's so good in it. And I can't say enough about the score. I've got the soundtrack and I've listened to it. I used to just blast it in my car. People thought I was weird.
Well, it's rare that a soundtrack can stand on its own. Like you don't have to have ever seen The Last Temptation of Christ to enjoy that score.
Oh, absolutely,
for exactly what it is.
Yeah, it is a magnificent music score. Peter Gabriel did a beautiful job with it. Coming in at number 16, I can't believe this. Cape Fear. That's way too high.
Some people are really into Cape Fear.
I can't stand that movie. Scorsese's remake originally, Steven Spielberg was going to make it, and he wanted to cast Bill Murray as Max Cady.
Yeah.
I would pay to see that.
Oh, my God.
I would totally pay to see Bill Murray play that part. Turns a traditional legal thriller into something scary, twisted, and at times thrillingly revolting. This is Scorsese in Hitchcock mode, but he's too singular a filmmaker to do some sort of Brian De Palma-esque homage. Hey. Easy. Easy on the Brian De Palma slams, buddy. You just happen to be encountering the biggest Brian De Palma fan on the planet.
I would have liked to see Brian De Palma make Cape Fear.
Oh, sure. I like to see Brian De Palma make anything.
Brian De Palma is The Last Temptation of Christ.
Listen, you know, I like Brian De Palma so much, I adore Raising Kane. I love that movie. And I remember that was the angriest crowd I've ever seen in a movie theater. It was a promotional screening. WGCI gave away the tickets, and I got them through, you know, obviously because I'm a critic, we would sometimes get. And that was the only screening they were doing, which is not a good sign. Normally when they screen a movie like on a Thursday night, it's not a good sign, especially if there's not like a critic screening ahead of time. And I went, obviously, because I love De Palma, and people were throwing stuff. They were booing at the end of the movie. I thought there was going to be a riot in the theater. I love them. I think Lithgow's great in it. He's having a blast in that movie. But yeah, people hate that movie. I'm trying to think of De Palma movies. I hated his last one. I can't remember what it was called. Possession?
Oh, are we talking about Domino?
Oh, Domino was terrible too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Possession was bad. Domino was bad. He's made a couple of bad movies in the past.
Yeah, some real stinkers.
But Scorsese finds the pain and the sickness in De Niro's Katie, but the lawyer Sam Bowden, played by Nick Nolte and his family, De Niro has the showiest performance. You can sense him and Scorsese having fun just making a big Hollywood thriller that's this disturbing. It's not the finest art of Scorsese's career, but many of its images will last forever alongside some of his greatest films. And it led to one of the greatest Simpsons episodes ever. All right, yeah. Yeah, I'll go with that. I'll go with that for sure. Is that the episode where we're first introduced to Sideshow Bob stepping on rakes? Was that the first time they did that?
It might be.
Funny every time. Every time. I like when his brother shows up and it's played and it's voiced by David Hyde Pierce in the dam episode where he's going to blow up the dam. And David Hyde Pierce, he goes up behind David Hyde Pierce and he covers his eyes and he goes, guess who? And he goes, Maris?
You got to have the Frasier joke.
Oh,
come on,
man.
You must. But yeah, it must be the first. I think it's the first time that
the rake joke appears.
Well, it's a return of it's the return of guest star Kelsey Grammer as Sideshow Bob. So I think he appears one time before.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they do the rake bit.
I think the rake bit shows up the first time in the Cape Fear episode.
Yeah.
So always Sideshow Bob, always funny. Always funny. Every episode featuring Sideshow Bob is great. So, all right, more Scorsese talk. We got some texts coming in. We'll read those, and we'll take your phone calls at 312-981-7200, and we'll do that after the news, which is coming up next. Nature creatures would be desperados. Clutch at plausible deniability. Don't touch that dice. Roll the Bones.
No, Tess for Echo.
Oh, Tess for Echo, right. Wow. One little deep cuts on the Rush this morning. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Yeah. So we're talking about Martin Scorsese movies. Martin Scorsese has a new movie coming out, and it's a big one. It's called The Irishman. It's a 3.5-hour gangster epic with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Joe Pesci, and Harvey Keitel. Always exciting when Scorsese releases a movie, so we're talking about his best movies and ranking them. 312 area code says Raging Bull and Goodfellas are his best movies. Both great. Absolutely great. 815 area code says, I love The Age of Innocence. It's exquisite and moving. I do, too. I remember catching a lot of flack from my friends for liking that movie. Like, why is Scorsese making a Merchant Ivory film? What is happening? It's a really good movie. All right. Coming in at number 15 is The Last Waltz, which is sort of the definitive concert movie of all time. Featuring, you know, obviously the band, but you got Neil Young, Van Morrison, Muddy Waters, Eric Clapton, Ronnie Hawkins, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Neil Diamond. It is classically, it is a classic a concert movie. Coming at number 14, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. That's about right. I would put that at right around that area. Ellen Burstyn is ridiculously good in it. Ellen Burstyn is one of my favorite actresses on the planet. Really, truly, one of my favorite actresses on the planet. It might be, there, you know, that might also be one of the reasons why I lost it at the end of Interstellar, is because it's her playing the role.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love her. I mean, she's truly one of my favorite actresses of all time. And it just that, and it affected me even more because it was Ellen Burstyn. I'm like, oh man, it's Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah.
Is Alice the most fully realized female character of any Scorsese film? That's a distinct possibility. It's both an indictment of Scorsese's career and a recognition of how perfect a character Ellen Burstyn and Martin Scorsese created in his first Hollywood movie. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore feels both fussed over and lived in. It's remarkably assured, confident, and sensitive from a filmmaker who had just up to the year before that made a film about Catholic guilt, misogyny, and rage. Up to this point, Scorsese looked like a future star, and it appeared that he was capable of anything. Yeah, it's an unusual. A lot of people forget that he directed that movie because it's not like a Scorsese movie of any kind.
No.
And it's female-driven. And it inspired a sitcom. I always think it's hilarious. I talked about this yesterday the day before when we were talking about 70s sitcoms. I always think it's hilarious that Alice, the sitcom with Linda Lavin, was inspired by a Martin Scorsese movie. It's like, wow, okay. Number 13 is After Hours. Too low. Too low. I love After Hours. I adore that movie. I would put it maybe in my top 5 Scorsese movies. That's how much I love After Hours. It is such a great movie. In a sense, After Hours is a movie about how Martin Scorsese couldn't get his then-dream project, The Last Temptation of Christ, off the ground. Frustrated, he decided to blow off steam by working on a down-and-dirty, dark comedy about a working stiff, played by Griffin Dunne, who gets sucked into a surreal night of beautiful women, dangerous men, and weird farce. I thought it was a whole metaphor for the way we are living and for what I went through in L.A. trying to get The Last Temptation made, Scorsese once said. I just had a ball with it because it meant so much to me. I asked myself, can I make a picture with the same energy that I had when I was 32? And I did. He was 42 when After Hours came out. And after years of aborted projects and commercial disappointments like The King of Comedy, the film felt alive and dangerous. The work of a director who quite simply just wanted to make a picture. Its giddy punk rock purity remains intoxicating. Do you like After Hours?
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's it's got an interesting place in his filmography. I would largely agree with the Vulture, but I'd put a little bit lower. It's not something I'm going to revisit that often, but
That for me, that's you know, our good friend Colin Suter. That's his favorite Scorsese movie.
It's After Hours.
Yeah, it's his favorite Scorsese movie. It's in my top five. I would put After Hours in my top five, and I think Griffin Dunne is great in it, and it's very funny and really twisted, and creepy, like scary.
Yeah,
and do you remember
different.
Do you remember his cameo?
Oh, God, what is he doing that one? It's been ages.
Scorsese in After Hours.
I don't remember.
When Griffin Dunne is in the nightclub running through by the fence, Scorsese is the spotlight operator. He's like a robotic spotlight operator in it.
Jeez.
Yeah, no, After Hours, man, I really liked it. And you know, I think it deserves a little bit more respect than it gets. I think a lot of people are kind of dismissive of it because it didn't make a lot of money when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And he just made it on a lark. Cheech and Chong are in it, man.
That is true. Tommy Chong's in that new Nick Cage movie.
Yeah. Hey, you know who's fantastic in After Hours? Terry Garr.
Yeah, Terry.
Oh my God. Oh my God. All the women. Catherine O'Hara is great in it.
Yeah,
Rosanna Arquette. Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah.
It's a terrific movie, man.
I do appreciate that in the credits, he's listed as Thomas Chong.
Oh yeah, he is. Thomas Chong, as opposed to Tommy Chong. That's a Scorsese movie. Yeah,
Mr. Thomas Chong.
That's right. I would be Nicholas DiGilio if I were in a Scorsese movie.
Oh, yes.
Scorsese, man. Oh man.
I'd still be Tom Hush.
Yeah. All right.
It's still snappy.
Next is the number 12 on the list is Age of Innocence. Which I like a little bit more than I think most people do.
Yeah, the average bear.
An Edith Wharton costume drama would seem the opposite of Scorsese's inclinations, but as usual, if you thought Scorsese was just about gangsters and violence, that said more about you than it did about him. Scorsese realized that passion, disguised and repressed, like in this case, in the case of crushed, devastated Newland Archer, Daniel Day-Lewis is one of his most underappreciated performances, can be as emotionally violent as the blood spurting out of Jake LaMotta's eye. Scorsese's famous attention to detail has never looked so lush or luxurious. Everything is so beautiful and exquisite that it just accentuates how raw and aching the characters are underneath it all. Yeah, I gotta say, I was really surprised at how much I liked Age of Innocence. I really was, because I was being a little cynical about it, too, you know?
Sure.
Because, you know, I'm like, Scorsese, what is he doing? But I thought it was a gorgeous movie. It is, and just, if anything, just like to look at that movie is breathtaking. Like, it is a beautiful, who shot that movie?
So that was shot by, let's see here, Michael Ballas.
Oh, sure.
Who is an immensely talented.
Yeah,
player.
He's shot a lot of Scorsese movies. Now, here's one that I don't like, besides Cape Fear. There's the other one, I don't like The Wolf of Wall Street. I do not like The Wolf of Wall Street.
Is it just because it's...
He's made Taxi Driver already. You mean
Goodfellas?
Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Because if you close your eyes and listen to the voiceover of DiCaprio, he sounds exactly like Ray Liotta.
He does.
And it's unnecessary. And it's way too long.
I do find it immensely entertaining, though, and a very important look into the opulence and excess of the late 80s and early 90s.
Listen, that's you are in the majority.
Yeah.
I'm definitely in the minority on this one, because when it came out, everybody loved it. And it made a lot of money, and people thought it was great and very entertaining. I did not like it.
What about Jonah Hill as Donnie Azoff?
No.
Or you've got Rob Reiner as his dad, too.
Yeah,
the conversation they have.
I've only seen it once.
Really?
Yeah, I've only seen it once. I disliked it. I disliked it when it was over. I was like, gee, and you know, and it was so long. I mean, I know that The Irishman is 3.5 hours long.
Yeah,
The Wolf of Wall Street felt like it was 10 hours long.
Did I ever tell you how I saw that movie?
Oh, you saw The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, Christmas Day, Whole family.
Oh, right. That's right.
Mom was just like, you know what? We're going to do something different. My dad had passed the year before, and she's just like, you know what? We're going to do something different. We're going to do something different for Christmas this year. We're going to go to the movies. We've never done that before. Let's do this. What's out?
Oh, man.
Let's go see The Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese. It's Leo DiCaprio. Yeah. That opening scene where he's doing blow. I'm like, come on. My brother couldn't have been older than 12 at the time.
I mean, you know, and, you know, Margot Robbie, I mean, what can you say about that?
Yeah.
I mean, my God.
Talk about talent.
I liked her in the movie.
I mean, it totally launched her career.
Oh, yeah.
It totally launched her career.
Rampant exposure to this movie on cable suggested Scorsese's bilious portrait of Jordan Belfort may soon join Goodfellas as one of the director's most intensely rewatchable efforts. Really? And like Goodfellas, that evergreen entertainment value doesn't mean Scorsese admires the denizens he's chronicling. The Wolf of Wall Street is a three-hour deep dive into greed and arrogance, removing the moral guardrails that usually insulate viewers so they can fully appreciate and be horrified by the sickening approaches and overindulgence on display. DiCaprio is glorious as Belfort, an absolute jerk before he's rich and even a bigger one afterwards. Meanwhile, Scorsese utilizes his old tricks, rocking soundtracks, swirling cameras, multiple voiceovers to unearth a Wall Street ecosystem that's immune to the laws and ethics the rest of us have to obey. Kyle Chandler is the one glimmer of decency in the film, and he's treated very shabbily. Sometimes the film's examination of excess can be excessive, but Wolf of Wall Street is hypnotizing and a damning condemnation of us poor rubes. So... yeah, I can't go there with that.
Fair enough.
Can't.
Fair enough. I know a lot of people that don't like it. I don't think you're as in the minority as you might think. Yeah. There's a lot of people that I've met that really have a problem with Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. Now, the next movie that we're going to talk about after the break is absolutely one of my favorites and is not considered one of his, you know, like his most revered movies. But it is absolutely one of my favorites that Scorsese has ever made, and it's kind of an unusual choice. But so Scorsese's got a new movie coming out, and everybody's very happy about it. Now we're going to tell you about the weather, and we'll come back and break, and then wrap up the show and the Scorsese talk right here on a Thursday morning. Oh, I'm disappointed we're not going to hear two more songs. Who requested the ELO?
It's coming to us from James.
Oh, man, I'm a little disappointed. I'd love to hear two more ELO songs this morning. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories about beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5. Steve Grzanich is next at 5 o'clock with the opening bell, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Talking about Martin Scorsese and his movies. What are your favorites? The Irishman opens tomorrow. A 3.5-hour gangster epic with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Joe Pesci and Harvey Keitel. It's got all the makings of what could be great. So we got some texts that have come in. 312-981-7200. 724 area code says, I didn't like Wolf of Wall Street as much as I thought I would and should, and that's disappointing because I used to do for a living. I used to do that for a living and absolutely love Boiler Room and Wall Street. 815 area code says, Boiler Room was a way better look at the 80s than Wolf. Get some Boiler Room fans out there. All right, this article from Vulture.com ranks the Scorsese movies, and we're at number 10. And here's the one that I was teasing before the break. I love this movie and would put it in the top three or four, The Aviator. I adore that movie, and I think DiCaprio is fantastic. And, of course, Cate Blanchett won the Academy Award for it. The crash scene? Oh, my God. Another project that was batted around from director to director, including Michael Mann, Milos Forman, and Christopher Nolan. It ended up in Scorsese's hands. It's a great movie about Howard Hughes. I love that movie, and I love the way it captures Hollywood. It is so beautifully photographed and edited, and the acting is so good. I think it's a great movie, a beautiful Hollywood epic. Do you like The Aviator?
I do like it. I think it is a really good turn for Leo. I think The Aviator is when I started taking Leo really seriously.
Uh-huh.
Because prior to that, I was just like, oh yeah, Titanic, big deal.
Well, had you seen This Boy's Life?
No. I had not seen it yet. Okay. I hadn't seen The Basketball Diaries yet.
Yeah.
I had not seen...
Well, This Boy's Life was right out of the gate. I was like, this guy's unbelievable. This kid's unbelievable.
All I knew him as was 90s heartthrob.
Right.
Aviator changed that for me. I have said, this guy's serious.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
I've always been a fan of his. And it's because it's because I saw This Boy's Life when it first came out. And I was like, this kid is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Toe-to-toe with De Niro in that movie.
Yeah. To me, he was, I think, I caught him on Growing Pains.
Yeah, he was on Growing Pains, yeah.
Down Thick.
Yeah.
So, you know, no, I took him very seriously. I mean,
Titanic changed everything for the guy. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, it changed everything. And, you know, he became like a superstar and a heartthrob. And I've said this before, about Titanic, because I backed that movie. I've said this before. When that boat hits the iceberg, the rest of that movie kicks ass. It's great. Before that, you know, the romantic stuff, it goes on for too long. But once that boat hits the iceberg, that movie rules. So, and again, you want to play a drinking game. Drink every time they say Jack and or Rose. Every time, because they say, I don't know what the number is, but they say each other's names like 5,000 times in that movie.
I do love Billy Zane.
Yeah, Billy Zane. You should listen to your friend Billy Zane.
I have a child.
Yeah.
I have a child.
By the way, his lovely sister Lisa's got a gig coming up. Maybe we can get her back on.
Yeah, we'll see if she's around.
They rank The Irishman number 9. So they've seen it, and they like it, which is a good sign. Good sign. Number 8 is Shutter Island. Pretty high on the list, Shutter Island.
It's got a lot of fans.
Yeah. We were talking about it a little bit earlier. It's a terrific movie. Number 7 on the list is, there you go, your favorite, The Departed.
There you go.
I do like the movie. I think it's really great. I just don't think it's... I wouldn't, you know, say it's my favorite.
Your boy Marky Mark is batting
fantastic
1,000.
Fantastic in that movie. All the supporting performances are great in The Departed. Well, actually, all the performances are great in The Departed.
Oh.
Nicholson's having a blast in that movie.
Oh, who are you? I'm the guy who does his job. You must be the other guy.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
How are you doing?
Good, man.
Now, one of my favorite directors, man. I really appreciate that... You had the Raging Bull playing at your screening. I took my son to see it. He loved it.
That was fun, man, to host a screening of Raging Bull. That was just so much fun.
And the first time I came across Scorsese, I grew up in New York, and the WNBC outlet on Sunday nights from the 60s through the 70s used to show edgy movies, foreign movies, new wave movies,
and by
mid-70s they were showing the new school Hollywood movies at late night on Sundays, and they showed Mean Streets.
Oh, man.
Mean Streets. And at that time, they didn't have the sophisticated bleeping technology or where they'd have words.
Yeah.
So whenever the language got a little over the top, they'd have clashing garbage cans.
Oh, is that right?
On the soundtrack.
That's hilarious. No, yeah, actually, Mike, Mean Streets is my second favorite Scorsese movie.
It's a great movie.
It is a phenomenal movie. And I mean, the brawl in the pool room is hilarious. What's a mook? That whole thing. They scam those kids out of the money, and then they go see The Searchers.
And don't forget the Carradine brothers.
Yeah.
Robert Culkin.
So it's such a weird scene. It is such a weird scene. And I just and De Niro's great in it, and I love the real abrupt ending. I thought it was. I adore that movie. I really do. And I think it's Keitel's best performance ever. Is in Mean Streets.
Great movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I mean, oh, man, I just got blown away.
Yeah.
So
it also I like
everything Scorsese does.
Yeah, me too. So. But it also has one of the most accurate depictions of what it's like to be drunk ever in a movie. When Keitel is loaded and the camera's shaking and everybody's throwing stuff in his face, it's fantastic. So,
yeah.
All right, Mike. Thanks, man.
All right, buddy.
Okay, Mean Streets. Number 6, way too high. Here's another one that I don't like very much, Casino.
I think Casino is good. It's probably the lesser, to me, of a lot of his gangster pictures.
Yeah.
But it's got some great moments. Like
it's got Don Rickles.
Yeah. Puts the guy's head in the vice.
Oh, no, man. Yeah, Casino did not do it for me at all. I liked Don Rickles, and I didn't like the fact that he got smashed in the head with a phone. That was the only thing I didn't like. Number 5 is Mean Streets. Again, my second favorite of all his movies. 4, King of Comedy, ranked really high, as it should be.
That's a good move.
A really underrated movie. Number 3, Raging Bull, which I thought would be number 1. And Raging Bull, obviously a great film. Number two is Taxi Driver, which is my favorite, and number one is Goodfellas.
There you go.
Yeah. And I can understand that. I mean,
when you have those three, you can kind of just move them around interchangeably and make a good argument.
He just, Goodfellas is just such a legendary movie, man. Here's funny. The first time I saw Goodfellas, and I've only seen it about 17,000 times. The first time I saw Goodfellas, I went with my buddy Scott Oaken. We went to a screening of it. And we were running late, so we didn't have time to get anything to eat. Now, have you ever been hungry while you're watching Goodfellas? Because it's torture. It's torture.
A lot of good food.
There's a ton of great food. And I'm Italian, man, and I love my Italian food. And we were both like sitting there going, oh, and it's almost 3 hours long. Goodfellas is a long movie. So we're like, oh God. We immediately went to like a Burger King or something afterwards and just scarfed. I was so hungry. Come on, man. The scene where they're in jail and they're cooking, the razor blade, Paul Sorvino with the razor blade and the garlic. Scorsese's real dad working on the sausage.
Yeah.
It's oh,
amazing.
And it's such a great movie. It is such a great movie. You know that the studio wanted to cut the scene with his mother out? With the, when she brings out her painting?
Yeah.
I like this guy. His dog said, what do you want from me? Hey, can I borrow this knife? Because I'm going to stab a guy to death with it.
Oh, jeez.
Such a great movie. Oh, man. I mean, there's a reason why. And then, I mean, that whole sequence with the helicopters. What can you say about that sequence? It's just amazing.
Pure paranoia?
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. So... All right, so that's Scorsese. I'm really looking forward to the Irishman. I got a good feeling about it. I'm really looking forward to it. So, hey, tomorrow we're going to talk with a guy who wrote a book about Match Game.
Match Game 101.
Match Game 101 is the name of the book. We'll talk with the author, and obviously Match Game, greatest game show of all time. So we'll talk all about that tomorrow on the show, and have all the regular Friday features. So make sure you tune in for that.